Welcome you to today's internet seminar on closeout procedures for NPL sites. This is training that's been sponsored by Australia's Construction and Post-Construction Management Branch. My name is Jean Ballant, and I work in the technology in Australia, and I'll be helping to moderate today's session. We're going to begin the formal presentation in just a few minutes. We'll give a couple extra seconds for some latecomers to hop on the line, and while we're waiting for them to join us, I'm going to cover some basic housekeeping items. Again, Clue-in seminars, if you haven't participated, operate very similar to a conference call. Each individual participant will join us either by listening on the phones or by streaming the audio through their computer speakers. Everyone also has to open up a copy of the training materials either on a web browser window or download them as PowerPoint or PDF files. Our presenters will manually announce as they move through the materials so each person can then turn the page on their own. If you haven't done so already, please download a copy of today's PowerPoint materials. They were available when you registered. If you go to that same seminar homepage, you can click the button to go to seminar that appears on the left, and that'll open up the slides in the web browser window. Alternatively, you can click the links at the bottom to download them as PowerPoint or PDF files. And with that, I'm going to ask everyone to move on past slide number one and move along to slide number two. If you're on the phones and you haven't done so already, please mute your phone line. You can either use your own mute button or hit star 6 to mute your phones. When we get to the designated points for questions with our presenters today, there will be slides indicating as such, and at that time, I'll remind you how to take yourself off of mute to ask your questions by phone. Until then, please stay muted. Do not put the call on hold. There might be commercial or background music which will be disruptive to us today. For those of you that are streaming the audio online, you won't be asking questions out loud. Instead, you're going to use one of the icons that appears at the top of your slide. You'll notice there are a series of orange icons at the top. The arrows pointing to left and right will help you move through the materials. One arrow pointing to the right will advance one slide. An arrow pointing to the left will move you back one slide. You can also use the numbered links that appear on the far left. At the very top, you'll also see a question mark icon. As long as your pop-up blockers have been disabled, a new window will open up, and you can use that to type up a comment or question, as well as report technical problems. You don't have to wait to the Q&A breaks to type up your questions. Please, in fact, do that as soon as they occur to you, so we'll create an online question queue. When we get to the breaks for Q&A, I will read those questions out loud on your behalf so our presenters can answer you. A final reminder for today's session is that it is being recorded, and with the organizer's permission, we'll provide you automatically when the archive is ready a link to download and replay. When we're all said and done today, I'll point you guys to two final links, which include an opportunity to download the seminar slides, the guidance document, etc., from the seminar resources page. And I'll also provide you a link to our short feedback form, which I do ask you guys to fill out. It takes just a minute or two. If you're sharing the line with multiple people and you want records of your participation for training credits, stay on the line until we get to the feedback form, and I'll explain how you can do that. That is the end of the official reminders I have for today. So again, you should be here for a closeout procedures for NPL sites training. And again, today's session is going to talk about that guidance, which was updated and reissued in May 2011. The guidance addresses policy related to remedial action completions, construction completions, site completion, deletion, and partial deletion. And so this three-hour training will have separate modules addressing each of these policy areas. If you can, it's recommended you have a copy of that guidance document available to you. You can find that linked on the seminar homepage. Our instructors today will be Jennifer Hovis, also coming from Australia's Construction and Post-Construction Management Branch, and Kate, and I'm going to mispronounce your last name, Kate.
Garufi.
Thank you so much, coming from the same group. So with that, I'm going to move everyone along to slide number three, and I will turn it over to your presenters today.
All right. Thank you, Jean. This is Jennifer Hovis. And
slide numbers are going to be good.
We will go ahead and advance to slide number four, and this is basically an outline of the guidance that was finalized in May of 2011. Kate and I were the primary authors, and so we're going to be dividing up this training. I will be covering chapters 2 and 3, which is remedial action completion and construction completion, and then she will be covering chapters 4 and 5, site completion, and then deletion and partial deletion. And again, we definitely do recommend that you have the guidance open. There's references to a few graphics and things that I think will be a little bit easier if you are able to look at them at your desk than the size that some of them may be on the slides. So we'll go ahead to slide 5. Getting into remedial action completion and slide 6. sorry, these are quick. we are going to be covering first the remedial action completion, which is chapter 2. I'll briefly mention chapter 1, there's not much substance there in the guidance. It's a general introduction to how to go through the document. So we'll be skipping over that and going right into chapter 2. We'll be talking about RA project completion, and that's a term that a lot of you have probably heard in relation to a new program measure. And then we'll be talking about the RA report, which is the primary documentation for documenting RA completion. Slide 7. So what's new about the 2011 version of the guidance with respect to remedial action completion? There's three main things. There are some new guidelines in the document related to using multiple remedial action projects within a single site. The primary reason that we focus on this area in the guidance is because of the new measure for RA project completion that came out in 2010 and officially became a reporting measure in 2011. Once you create a measure that has some visibility, you obviously want to make sure that you have good guidance in place on how to break up a site and get credit for that measure. So we'll cover that in the next few slides. We also added more detail to this version of the guidance compared to the previous version in terms of outlining specific criteria and guidelines for completion based on the type of remedy that you're implementing, whether it's a source remedy, a groundwater remedy, trying to be more clear in the guidance when you will achieve that completion milestone based on the technology and the goal. And then finally, with the new guidance, we're no longer distinguishing between interim and final RA reports. That was a distinction that was made in the previous guidance, and towards the end of this chapter, I'll explain kind of what the logic was there on renaming and changing the approach to those documents. Slide 8. So what is a remedial action? Our definition in the guidance is the actual construction or implementation of a discrete scope of activity supporting a Superfund site cleanup. So it's actually the physical work that we are taking to implement a remedy that was in a ROD. Slide 9. There is some new information in the guidance that tries to outline the distinction between operable units and remedial actions or RA projects and how to use them together most effectively to carry out an overall remedy at a site. And so an OU, I think a lot of folks hopefully are familiar with that term, generally has come to refer to whether it's a geographical area or a particular media, or in some cases kind of a chronological phase of an overall site cleanup. The remedial action project, on the other hand, or the remedial action, really is the physical action of implementing a remedy at an operable unit. There is not necessarily a direct correlation between one RA project per one OU. There's no direct correlation for how many rods can be at an OU. It's really quite dynamic based on the situation at your site. And it's important to note that the term RA project really is a relatively new term that came about when we created the new measure. It was thought that it would be a little more clear to the public and to kind of outside overseeing parties when we're talking about the new measure. In reality, I think it's caused some confusion on the inside within EPA, but we really want to emphasize that the term remedial action or RA and RA project are completely synonymous. So RA project is not a smaller subunit within a remedial action. They really are synonymous terms, and they refer to, for those of you that do your own direct surplus planning, they refer to the action level in CERCLIS, your remedial action or your PRP RA on your schedule in CERCLIS. So, and then I mentioned there may be one or more OUs or one or more RA projects even per OU at a site. Okay, so we're on slide 10. I mentioned that this guidance has a bit more detail on using multiple RA projects at a site. This came about because of a general concern that as we ramped up for the new measure, that we didn't want it to appear that we were arbitrarily inflating the number of RA project completions we could have in order to inflate our accomplishments. We certainly did not want to be accused of that. And so we wanted to provide some basic guidelines on when it's appropriate to use multiple RAs to carry out work at a site. We certainly want to encourage, first of all, that it's at the discretion of the region and the site manager how best to carve up work at a site in order to carry out in the most efficient and effective manner. The guidance does stress that it's based on best professional judgment and that really that should be based on sound engineering and project management analysis. It obviously is going to vary by site depending on the size and the complexity of your site, and certainly may vary. You know, you may have one remedy that covers a very large area, and it may make sense to carve up even one remedy into multiple projects. And so some of the factors outlined in the guidance to consider that, say if you have a large sediment remedy that needs to be carved up into multiple kind of lengths or reaches of a river, there may be certainly valid reasons to do that. Some of the factors laid out in the guidance mention that you may have multiple parties conducting work in different areas of a site. You may have areas of a site where you don't have access yet and you need to move on to other areas, and so you may have separate projects based on access. Certainly, depending on your contracting structure and who is actually conducting the work, you may decide to carve a remedy into multiple projects. So the next slide, slide 11, is a basic scenario that we're actually going to follow through the entire training today to try to emphasize each of the definitions for completion of the milestones we're going to cover. And hopefully by carrying kind of one scenario through the training, you'll be able to see the distinctions between RA completion, construction completion, site completion, and such. So this is the same scenario that we're going to talk about throughout the training. It's just a very basic scenario where we'll say that we have one site-wide rod that for a site that has been divided into two operable units. The first OU is soil, where the remedy was a basic dig and haul. And then the second operable unit is groundwater, where we have three different remedies. We have an in-situ remedy for an on-site plume, and then we have M&A for the off-site plume, and then we also have institutional controls to limit well drilling. So for right now, what I'm just going to cover is, you know, looking at this, there really are a variety of ways that you could divide the work at this site into multiple RA projects. The most likely scenario that we have seen out of headquarters is probably that OU1 would be one project that you would task your contractor to go out and do the dig and haul work and then complete that. And then you would have a separate RA project for your groundwater restoration work with your ISCO and your M&A would likely be one project. And then institutional controls may lag, and we'll see some of those scenarios as we get further into the training. Of course, because we stress that it's at the discretion of the site manager, there are a lot of different ways that this could shake out, but that would be the most likely scenario that we would see. Slide 12. RA completion, the actual definition of when we achieve RA completion is when the designated regional official, which is usually the branch chief, maybe higher, approves the RA report. For all the complicated things we're going to talk about in this module, it's kind of silly to me to say something as simple as RA completion is when someone signs the RA report. In reality, the tricky part of RA completion is what is the right time to do an RA report for a project, and that's what we're going to get into. When is the right time that you have completed the work and that the RA report is now appropriate? And that is very much going to vary based on the type of remedy that you're implementing for your RA project. In general, I think it's easiest to think of RA completion as signifying that cleanup goals have been achieved for your remedy in all remedy scenarios except groundwater and surface water restoration. And we'll get into the intricacies of that, but you know, in general, I think it's easiest to keep in mind that RA completion means that you have achieved your cleanup goals for all other types of remedies except for restoration. Slide 13. The closeout procedures guidance does touch just a little bit on these other key terms that are related to remedial action. The guidance is not comprehensive on these issues in any way, although we will point you to some references where they exist. But I just want to run through some quick definitions for ONF, LTRA, PRP-LR, which is similar to LTRA, and then operation and maintenance, and it'll help you have some context as we're talking about each of our remedial action scenarios. So on slide 14, for operational and functional, a remedy becomes operational and functional either a year after construction of the remedy is complete or when the remedy is determined concurrently by EPA and the state to be functioning properly and performing as designed, whichever is earlier of those two milestones. Operational and functional is a determination that is specific to the remedy, so each remedial action should have its own ONF determination, and it's completely unrelated to the site-wide construction completion determination. So sometimes people get thrown off by this definition of 1 year after construction is complete. That is construction of the remedy that you're making the RA, or that you're making the ONF determination for. In general, ONF should be made for any remedy that's going to have an O&M component. M&A even does get a simplified ONF determination because really the ONF determination will set the schedule for when the state is going to take responsibility for O&M at fund finance remedies. ONF should certainly be well documented. If you're looking at it as a one-year ONF period, we suggest in general that you have a joint inspection when the remedy has been constructed, and then that would start the one-year period, and that you document the start of that one-year period and then also the completion of that one-year period, and that the SSC really is a great place, particularly for fund finance remedies, to be outlining the expectations for ONF, because the expectations are very specific to the remedy itself. Next, slide 15, we'll cover LTRA, the long-term response action. Folks are probably pretty familiar with it. It refers to the fund-financed restoration of groundwater and surface water. And specifically, the LTRA period is the 10-year period between the operational and functional determination and the start of operation and maintenance. It's really an extension of the RA funding arrangement where EPA continues to pay 90% of the action and the state chips in their cost share. But really, the day-to-day activities during LTRA look more like O&M. So it's kind of a cross between the RA and the O&M. In the scenario where you're looking at PRP lead restoration remedies, that work really is O&M by statutory definition. But we created the PRP-LR term in order to help our tracking and reporting, basically. So it's a way for us to tell in our systems that we have a restoration remedy and distinguishing it from O&M. The 10-year time frame does not apply in the PRP-LR scenario. Federal facilities, those do not have an LR. They go directly to O&M from the RA. Okay, slide 16, operation and maintenance. O&M basically refers to the activities that are necessary to maintain the effectiveness and integrity of a remedy. O&M may be indefinite if you're talking about scenarios where we're containing groundwater or we've installed a landfill cap, and those things will have to be maintained in perpetuity. For restoration remedies, the actions that do have an LTRA, O&M refers to the continued operation of the remedy after LTRA. And the most important thing to remember is that O&M is strictly the responsibility of states or PRPs and not EPA. We are, in fact, prohibited from paying for any O&M. Before we move on to the next slide, this might be a good spot to stop and see if any questions have come in or if anybody wants to chime in on the phone with kind of questions on the basic definitions before we get into covering each of the scenarios and remedial actions and their completion criteria.
If you're on Jen,
this is Region 10. And I have never, this is Tim Ritchell, we got several RPMs in the room and more coming. I don't think I've ever heard that particular phrasing before that we never do O&M? You want to expand on that a little?
Well, I guess O&M can mean a lot of things. EPA, we are not legally allowed to fund operation and maintenance. And so there may be activities at a site that appear to be O&M-like because they're happening during LPRA or such, but really, if it is a remedy that is in O&M, responsibility that's transferred to the state, EPA is prohibited from funding those activities.
What if it's settlement dollars?
What about if it's being done with settlement dollars?
That would be a different scenario. If you have special account money can be spent on O&M depending on, you know, what the settlement actually does. So this is talking about trust fund appropriated trust fund dollars.
All right, that helps. Thank you.
Yeah, and the at the end, we do have links to other guidance documents. There is a good comprehensive O&M fact sheet, and there'll be a link to the post-construction website that has all those resources at the very end of the training. So I'm not sure that it touches on the special account issue, but...
Anybody else on the phone, it's #6 to unmute your line if you have a question. And then for those of you streaming the audio, I haven't had any submitted electronically, but if you need to type up a question or comment, you want to click the question mark button at the top of your slide, and that'll open a new window so you can type up your comment or question. So if you have one, do it, and we'll get to it at the next break.
Okay, we're going to get into the fun stuff now. Slide 17. Basically, so as I mentioned at the very start of this module, one of the improvements that we tried to make to this guidance was to call out more specifically the RA completion criteria for different types of remedies. The previous guidance was a little more general in those criteria, and headquarters was receiving so many questions on, you know, what if I have a restoration remedy? What if I have a source treatment? That we tried to make it clearer. And so the next few slides are going to cover these four main RA completion categories, source remediation actions, source and groundwater containment actions, groundwater and surface water restoration actions, and then IC actions. And so for each of these, I'm going to cover kind of a general definition of the action and some examples. We'll cover the criteria, and then there's a kind of a visual graphic for those of you familiar with the guidance. This shows the pipeline for each of the scenarios. So moving on to slide 18, source remediation generally refers to actions that are taken to reduce or eliminate toxicity, mobility, or volume of contaminated source material. Most commonly, these actions are occurring through either on-site treatment or physically removing the waste from the site. And so some examples most commonly are excavation, soil vapor extraction, sediment dredging, and stabilization solidification remedies. Slide 19 shows the RA completion guidelines, I think is the language in the guidance since we're never allowed to say criteria, but these four items basically are needed in order to take credit for RA completion for source remediation actions. All construction activities for the action, the RA, are complete, including site restoration and demob. All of the REOs and cleanup levels specified in the ROD have been achieved. You've had a successful contract final inspection, which we'll talk about, and the RA report, of course, is consistent with the guidance and has been approved. So slide 20 has a simple little pipeline graphic. These will get increasingly more complicated as we go, that basically shows that you have the duration of your remedial action from your RA start and that you end with an RA report. There are some limited scenarios where maybe you would have some O&M required if you did, say, stabilization at your site. There may be some limited O&M, but for the most part, source remedies would not have an O&M component. Slide 21. We will get into source and groundwater containment remedies, which are pretty self-explanatory, basically that we would have, you're basically containing waste material on-site permanently, and so that may be source control, landfill cap, or physical measures to control migration of contaminated groundwater. Slide 22 has the RA completion criteria for containment remedies. Basically, similar to source remedy or source remediation, all construction activities are complete, including site restoration and demo. RAOs have been achieved, and data indicate that containment has been achieved and that you've made your ONF determination, which is, for containment remedies, pretty similar to number two, obviously. A successful contract final inspection has been conducted, and again, your RA report consistent with the guidance and has been approved by the appropriate regional official. So slide 23 is the pipeline depiction of the containment action, and it basically is showing that you would do your inspection after you've constructed the containment remedy, and that would kick off your up to 1 year operational and functional period where you're doing some shakedown. At the end of that period, you would hopefully make a successful ONF determination, and shortly thereafter, you would be finalizing an RA report, and then you would be kicked into ONM immediately after that remedial action. And of course, in this scenario, that ONM would be funded by either the state or the PRP. Slide 24. Moving into the discussion of groundwater and surface water restoration remedies, which are definitely unique in terms of RA completion criteria, restoration remedies refer to those with the objective of returning all or part of a surface water body or groundwater aquifer to the beneficial use specified in the ROD. The most common scenario for restoration remedies certainly is restoring a current or potential drinking water aquifer to MCLs. The timing for the RA report is unique. If you recall earlier, I said that it's easiest to think of RA completion as achieving your RAOs and your cleanup levels for all remedies except restoration remedies. And so because of the expected duration of how long restoration remedies will have to operate, it's necessary for us to document RA completion in order to start the LTRA clock or move into PRPLR. And so in order to do that, we basically are declaring RA completion before we have achieved cleanup goals for restoration remedies. Slide 25. What that means basically, looking at the criteria for restoration remedies, is that you will have constructed your treatment system. For in situ remedies, the delivery of your appropriate reagent is underway. The monitoring network is installed. You have enough information to declare the remedy operational and functional. You've done a contract final inspection and that you have your RA report approved. Now, an important distinction for restoration remedies comes down to the in situ scenario. As you guys probably know, this is an increasingly common area, or increasingly common technology used at sites. And what we've seen is that there are differences, I think, in the way that people are approaching an operational and functional determination for in situ remedies. And so the key language, while it may be subtle here, is that on number two, for in-situ remedies, delivery of the appropriate reagent is underway, not complete. So our anticipation with this guidance is that you will begin doing injections if you have, say, ISCO. You would do enough sampling to monitor that it is anticipated to work, and you are able to make an ONF determination, and you would complete RA and move into LTRA where those injections would continue. That is a little bit different than maybe how it's being done in some scenarios, and so this guidance is hopefully going to result in more consistency on that issue. If your goal is groundwater restoration, then you don't stay in your remedial action phase for the entire duration of your injections. You do need to close your RA and move into LTRA. If you are doing in situ for source material, which is very different than groundwater restoration, then you would potentially stay in remedial action because your goal there is to address source material, not groundwater. And so I'm going to expect we'll have some questions on that the next time we pause for questions.
That's an interesting distinction. We would ask that you kind of run through that one more time, please.
Okay, I will do that. So this is where it becomes important to think of completion criteria by media and objective, you know, RAO in your rod, not only the remedy in place. So you cannot determine completion and whether LPRA is appropriate just because you're doing ISCO. You need to evaluate what is the goal and what is the media being addressed and what is the end point that's stated in the rod. Is that end point to clean up a soil concentration or remove a certain mass of waste material or DNAPL, or is your goal to restore groundwater to MCL? So with that distinction, basically, if you are doing an in-situ remedy to address source, and your definition of success, basically, is to knock down a certain volume or mass of source, or to reach a certain soil cleanup level, then your RA would continue up until the time that that RAO has been achieved, and you stay in remedial action. You, if you're fund weed, you're not transitioning anything to the state. If your goal with that in-situ technology is to restore groundwater to MCLs, then you do have an LPRA scenario, and those injections would continue during LPRA, and depending on whether they last 10 years or more, which they rarely do, you would potentially transition to O&M. So I'm fine pausing here for more questions.
I have a question. This is Lynn Sewer, Region 9. And would you please talk some more about the surface water restoration aspect, where presumably the goal would be to achieve ambient water quality criteria? And so I'm thinking perhaps of a mine site where you're treating added water that is acidic or contaminated with the objective of restoring a waterway. And so I don't see that you, this guidance seems to focus mainly on groundwater restoration of MCLs.
So what really does. The surface water issue is definitely a more complicated one, and it is not called out in the guidance the way that groundwater is, because it just isn't as common, and frankly, as your question indicates, it's a whole lot trickier. there's a lot of discussion on where sediment remedies come into play and whether sediment remedies technically are restoring surface water or not. Mining sites in particular, whether they can realistically be considered surface water restoration remedies or are they source control. In all honesty, I don't have a great answer to that question right now, other than the fact that we are lacking some guidance and we're aware of it, and we continue to tackle the issues site specifically. I don't know if anybody else in the room wants to expand. But
I think, this is Kate, one of the things that we look at, if you look at, I'm going to go back to groundwater even though this is a surface water question. When you talk about groundwater pump and treat, if you're doing a pump and treat, you're extracting the groundwater, treating it, and your goal is to achieve MCLs within the aquifer, that's called restoration, versus scenarios where you would extract the groundwater, treat it, and then send it to some endpoint use, whether it be drinking water, et cetera. Those generally aren't restoration. So what we generally look at for restoration is achievement of the goals within the media. So I guess generally with mine sites, it depends on how one interprets what you are restoring. If you're collecting water coming up and at it, you can argue that perhaps you are not restoring the surface water body. You're only preventing further degradation of a water body downstream. But again, we don't have clear guidance on it, and I think there's some folks in headquarters that are working on a post-construction guidance that's going to try to clarify some of these things, hopefully, maybe. We tried to do an acid mine drainage policy with the last administration, and it died. So I don't know where it's going to go with this. But I think what we would recommend is, if you have this type of situation, to consult with us about how you would approach the funding scheme when it is operational and functional and going into O&M. That would probably be the best recommendation.
Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Lynn.
Yeah, I just wanted to add that the situation that I'm, I guess, mainly referring to is one where you've got contamination in fish, so the end goal is really, like mercury contamination in fish, where the end goal is to restore fish tissue, but you do that by restoring water quality. So anyway, I'm hoping the guidance will address that situation.
Yeah, one angle that we were potentially thinking about is, you know, the distinction between a remedy that would need to operate forever and a remedy that would not need to operate forever. So in an ideal groundwater restoration scenario with a straight face, you could say that is not a remedy that is going to operate forever because you have a clear endpoint of MCLs. You anticipate reaching it in a reasonable time frame and that your pump and treat system, say, would not have to operate indefinitely in order to get there. In some of the surface water scenarios, that's a little trickier because you may have a clear end goal of what you want the surface water and the fish to look like, what the level should be at the end, but you may need to
contain something.
Contain that mine waste in perpetuity to make that restoration happen, and that's where we get into a gray area that is as yet unresolved.
And for me, Ben, if we could just ask, as we continue to look at this, generalized, don't, you know, as the questioner was just saying, that could be a surface water remedy, could be a sediment remedy, could be both.
Yeah,
Those are ones we do need to work on some more if we want any modicum of consistency.
Yes, and this is an area that is particularly difficult, obviously, to write guidance on. It is an area that we are increasing coordination here at headquarters. You know, those of us on the post-construction side, we don't evaluate or review draft rods. The folks that are reviewing the draft rods may not all of them be as in tune with the post-construction implications of the way rods are written. And so we're improving the coordination here, too, to make sure that, you know, we're kind of looking at the big picture so that rod language doesn't set us up for a scenario that anybody's uncomfortable with. So great question. Stay tuned. It's on our radar. It's just, you know, particularly tricky, as you can see. slide 26 is the visual depiction of the fund that is restoration remedies. This basically is trying to show that obviously the end of the pipeline does look a little different depending on who the lead is. So on the top of the pipeline, you're looking at a fund lead scenario, and below you're looking at a PRP or a federal facility scenario. And so you would still have an inspection upon construction of the remedy to start your O&F period. And then your O&F determination would be followed shortly thereafter by your RA report so that you could begin LTRA. And now LTRA is ideally supposed to begin upon O&F, not upon RA report signature. And so there can be a little bit of an overlap between RA, where your RA completion happens shortly after your LTRA begins. LTRA start really is supposed to be linked to O&F, not RA completion. That may not really be the case at a lot of older sites where our surplus guidance was more lacking in this area, but hopefully moving forward we're getting better on that. After 10 years of LTRA then, we would be moving into O&M state lead, O&M in that fund lead scenario on top, and then down below, as I mentioned, we would be in PRPLR for that entire duration after RA and O&F, or in federal facilities, it would be referred to as federal facility O&M because they don't use that LR to note those restoration remedies. So if we go on to slide 27, I want to touch briefly on why we got rid of interim RA reports.
Hang on 1 second before you transition. We had a slide, question on 26. I was a little slow on the mute button.
Okay, go ahead, Tim.
I'm trying to look back at what, you know, the NCP says, and, you know, it discusses a remedy. It doesn't make the distinction for remedial action and whatnot. And I know that that's come up in our situation where a rod, maybe, as you were saying, might have multiple what you would call remedial action. And the argument, you know, or the question that I have, and I've been out of this loop, so I apologize, it's already been asked.
Right,
if there is more than one remedial action in a rod.
Excuse me, can I stop you for just a second? Somebody else needs to make sure they're on mute if you're not the one asking the question.
Yeah, to mute, it's star 6, mute your line, unless you're asking the question. The other thing, for those of you that are in a conference room, We are broadcasting this through a couple components, so if you could move closer to the speakerphone, that'll definitely help some of our other remote participants. We're going to have our speakers do their best to repeat the question, so if people can't hear the speaker, hopefully you'll catch it before we get a response. And then the last reminder I'm going to have is we appreciate the questions and dialogue now, but in the interest of time, we want to be sure we hold those questions till the designated Q&A breaks, otherwise we're going to get off schedule. So I'll go ahead and let Jen answer the question.
And then we'll yeah, so go ahead and repeat the current one, and then we'll hold the rest of them to the end.
I'll just wait, and this is Mary Jane in Region 10. I'll just wait until that Q&A period. Sorry.
Okay. Sorry about that. We'll just want to make sure we keep moving, and then we'll do a larger Q&A. So thanks. So on 27, with respect to interim RA reports, so those of you that were familiar with the 2000 guidance and have probably been managing RAs and LPRAs in that time, that guidance made a distinction between with two types of remedial action reports to document RA completion. The premise was that a final RA report was used in all scenarios to note that cleanup goals had been achieved. And then for restoration remedies, an interim RA report was used to close out the RA before cleanup goals had been achieved in order to move it into LPRA. The reality is that that interim label was being used pretty inconsistently. Sometimes it was being used to refer to
you guys, I'm sorry, there's somebody laughing, so I'm going to globally mute all the phone lines. I apologize for the disruption. I'll provide instructions on how to unmute in a minute, but bear with me.
The leader has muted your line. To unmute your line, press #6.
Okay, thanks. Thank you, Jean. So the interim label, we saw scenarios pretty commonly where interim RA reports were being used basically for any remedy that came out of an interim ROD, whether it was restoration or not. We saw it used for any RA report that was anything but the very last RA report for a site. And since it was being used so inconsistently, we decided to kind of move away from that terminology in this guidance. And so basically, the new practice going forward with this guidance is to refer to all RA reports simply as RA report without the interim or final designation. But the timing and the, you know, when it's appropriate to do that RA report has not changed. We haven't, you know, altered when it's appropriate to do RA completion for restoration remedies just by getting rid of that interim label. In lieu of doing a final RA report now for those restoration remedies, Kate will touch on this more in the other modules coming up, but basically we would say that you could have monitoring data now that's going to show that you achieve those MCLs, and she'll get into that. So that is the explanation on the no more interim RA reports. I will say I know that a lot of statements of work, enforcement agreements, things like that obviously already exist referencing that this is a deliverable. We are not encouraging that anybody go in and change any of those agreements. This is just something that needs to hopefully be put into place as you move forward with your new SOWs and things. Slide 28. Institutional controls is the last of the four scenarios we're going to talk about. People are probably pretty familiar with what ICs are, but the general definition, we're talking about non-engineered instruments such as administrative and legal controls that minimize potential for human exposure to contamination and or protect the integrity of a response action. Most common examples being zoning restrictions, well drilling restrictions, easements, things like that. Slide 29, the criteria for RA completion of institutional controls actions gets pretty tricky. Obviously, ICs in themselves are complicated in terms of who is responsible for implementing them. Many times we decide after the fact that we need to go back and add them because we discover it during five-year reviews that they're missing. So the timing and the person implementing them, the party implementing them, tends to complicate the scenario. So the guidance generally lays out three primary scenarios and is written in a way to provide some flexibility on when we would declare RA completion in IC scenarios. It's written possibly with more flexibility than some of you would like, but maybe not enough for others. So the three main scenarios, the first one would be a situation where ICs are being implemented by a party that's different from the party that's constructing an engineered remedy. So say that your remedy is to build a pump and treat system to restore groundwater and also to temporarily restrict use of that groundwater at the same time. In that scenario, say it was fund lead, our contractor would be tasked with building the pump and treat system, and likely the state or local jurisdiction would be responsible for implementing the institutional control ultimately. And so in this scenario, we would likely do an RA completion and give credit for the project completion at the time that the engineered component is complete and that the ICs would probably lag and probably would not need their own RA report. There's a second scenario listed where ICs are fully integrated with the engineered components in a single RA project and that you've scoped it that way from the beginning. In a lot of cases, those are scenarios where we have negotiated with a PRP or federal facility to, you know, bundle work into a single project to make sure that all of the components are done. In that scenario, we likely would want to make sure that the ICs are implemented before we close out the RA with an RA report. And then we have a scenario where ICs may be the sole remedy in a decision document, which is referred to as a limited remedial action. Is not all that common, but in those scenarios, if ICs really were your sole remedy, then you would need to do an RA report at the end of implementing those ICs. There are probably 1,000 permutations of these scenarios that could happen, and so really this is an issue that site-specifically it comes to us fairly often, and it's probably best to handle it that way. That was kind of how we approached it in the guidance, because it really is difficult to kind of ferret out how best to address this issue. So, slide 30 covers the general inspections. Back one. Sorry. the inspections that are necessary in the span of an RA. We generally conduct contract pre-final and final inspections at the end of construction to determine whether the construction was completed in accordance with the contract design and specs. And so these are really contract inspections where it's EPA and the contractor at site and then others invited as appropriate. To make sure that the contract requirements were met. We do a pre-final inspection that may generate a punch list of items that need to be addressed before we can sign off on an absolute final inspection. And then there are other inspections that may happen depending on, you know, who's the lead at the site and other issues going on. So for fund lead projects, we mentioned when talking about ONF that there are there's a joint EPA and state inspection when the remedy has been constructed in order to kick off the ONF period. It may certainly in most situations make sense to have that inspection coincide with one of these contract pre-final or final inspections. And for PRP and federal facility projects, there likely are other inspections that are outlined in the consent decree or the FFA or other such things. And so, you know, you need to be aware of those requirements as well. Slide 31. This just covers the preparation, approval, and distribution of the RA report. The RA report generally is prepared not usually by the EPA RPM, but by the construction or oversight contractor, the party that is most familiar with the very detailed work that was done to conduct the remedial action. That does not prohibit an EPA RPM from writing it, but in general we see that the contractor takes the lead on that. The goal is to submit the RA report within 90 days of the final inspection. That is our general guidance in order to keep things moving in a timely way, although your enforcement agreements or statement of work with your contractor may have its own deadline that you should be aware of. But our hope, particularly with the fact that this is now a program measure, you know, that those reports are coming to us in a timely manner. For approval of the report, this is one of those rare documents that EPA headquarters actually does not have a formal review and concurrence role on. It is up to the region to review and approve the document. Written approval is by the regional EPA official. Sometimes it is a official distribution or a formal memo on top of that report, or you know, just the signature line accepting it. And then for distribution, headquarters does not have to receive it. It remains in the site file, obviously, in SDMS. And then you'll see throughout this entire training this note on notifying natural resource trustees. There was a guidance document back in 1997 that references our commitment to send documents to the trustees that mark major milestones, and so that is a requirement to try to do that within 1 week. Slide 32 is an outline of the RA report contents. If you're following, you have the guidance in front of you. Exhibit 2.5 is a pretty lengthy outline of the contents of the RA report. Something worth noting, two major things that we actually removed from the outline, not to say that you can't keep them in your reports, but we removed reference to cost information and to an analysis of lessons learned. And we did that primarily because those two items were not directly related to the achievement of RA completion. The cost information in particular was taking a long time to actually develop, and we weren't getting it, obviously, for PRP and facility actions in general. And so if you still want to document those things, we recommend that you can either have them as an appendix or you can document them in other ways in the site file, but we no longer want to delay the creation and approval of the RA report for those items that may have been slowing things down.
What was the second one? Just quick clarifying, what was the second one you said? We heard cost.
Cost, and there was a section in the previous one called Lessons Learned Analysis.
Thank you.
So basically the background, the RA report really is specific to the remedy that it's covering. It's not like other documents where you have to have a comprehensive overview of the full site and all of that. Because eventually all of your individual RA reports are going to be put together to help you create your final closeout report. And so the background is just really a description of the ROD and some details on the remedial design phase. Construction activities and chronology of events is just covering all of the specific activities that were done to implement the RA, any problems or deviations that you had, did you have some downtime, what kind of final sampling did you do, particularly going into performance standards and the construction quality control section, you know, what kind of monitoring did you do, what was your confirmatory sampling to document that you achieved cleanup goals, you know, if you're not at the restoration, if you don't have a restoration remedy. What type of EPA oversight was there for sampling and analysis for PRP and facility sites? So all these things, there's much more detail in the guidance on the contents of these sections, certainly because contractors write the majority of the reports. They do have an awful lot of experience writing them, but you may want to make sure that you share the new revised outline for these documents with your contractors once they write them to make sure that they're kind of up to speed on the more refined contents of the report. Slide 33, if you remember, we were going to revisit this little scenario throughout the training, and so let's talk now about RA completion for the project in this little example site. So if we work with the premise where I basically said OU1 would be one RA project for the dig and haul, and then OU2 would be one project combining the two groundwater remedies, and then the ICs would likely lag a bit. So Under OU1, you'd have RA completion when you effectively excavated and removed all of the waste from the site. You had confirmatory sampling that you had achieved cleanup goals with what's remaining on site, and then you successfully restored and completely demobilized from the site. And you'd have your final inspection to prove all of that, and then you would have to approve your written RA report. So that's the easy one. For OU2, the likely scenario being that the in situ and M&A would be one project where you would, if this is a funding scenario, you'd have tasked your contractor under one task probably to conduct both. You would be installing the monitoring wells and injection points for the ISCO and starting your injections and doing some sampling to prove that it's working so that you can make your ONF determination. You would also have installed monitoring wells for the M&A, maybe not your complete network, but the initial network that you need to demonstrate effectively M&A would really be kind of the threshold for your operational and functional determination there. So after ONF, you would be moving into LPRA, and so your injections would continue, your M&A would continue. We don't see many scenarios where injections continue past 10 years, so by the time your LPRA period was done, it's likely only the M&A that you are turning over to the state at that point. And then ICs, if you're successful in having them implemented during the RA phase, that's great, or certainly during the LPRA phase, that would be ideal, but they likely would be on their own and would not necessarily, you know, require an RA report and get RA project completion credit just for the ICs. That's always a very site-specific issue that headquarters and the regions talk through. So I will stop there. Slide 34, I think, is just our pause for questions. So we will open it up for...
Yeah. Again, if you're streaming the audio, you can type up a comment or question. If you click the question mark button above your slide, a new window will open up. We did get a couple of comments, so I'll continue to hold those in the queue. For those of you on the phone lines, this is your chance to unmute and go ahead and ask a question. We did globally mute the line, so you'll want to hit #6 to unmute your phone. And feel free to identify yourself and ask your question.
So Region 10 has the question we held before and possibly a second one. So Mary Jane's going to pick up here with one.
Okay. We got into a situation. This was a fund lease. We were going to be turning it over to the state for the long-term O&M. And in going back to the NCP, what I'm trying to figure out is the tie between the guidance and the NCP. The NCP uses the term remedy. It doesn't use remedial action. It doesn't use remedial action project. And I know we've got another very brief guidance that states that it's EPA's position that a remedy, you know, that is defined in a record of decision, can include more than one remedial action. But the state isn't necessarily buying that. I mean, they look at, okay, and let me just use a specific example. We have two geographic areas of sediment contamination, for example, and one of the areas is the selected remedy is just institutional controls exclusively. The other area is where we placed a cap and done some more active work. For both of the sites, though, for both of the areas, the remedial action objectives and remediation goals are to achieve the cleanup, the sediment cleanup standards. We would like to argue here in Region 10 that once the institutional controls are in place for the east area, if you will, and the remedial, what you guys are calling remedial action, the cap, if you will, are complete for the west side, that the state needs to take it over. The state is pointing back to the NCP and saying, but your remedy in your record of decision says that, you know, the remedial action objectives and the cleanup goals are the sediment criteria. We won't take either of them until those sediment criteria are achieved. And I can think of a handful of other examples where we're going to encounter that as well. So I guess fundamentally I'm trying to tie what your definitions are in this guidance back to what it specifies for operational and functional in the NCP, which uses the term remedy, not remedial action.
Okay. Yeah, that is an issue that we are familiar with, particularly with the states in Region 10. And there is no place in guidance or NCP or anything that easily spells out that each remedy transfers on its own. We've had this debate with a lot of states. In reality, there's nothing that we can clearly point to right now. It's likely on the list of things to be considered to go into the post-construction guidance that is under development, that's kind of the follow-on to this. From the ONS perspective, right now, the ONS section in the May 2011 closeout procedures, we tried to, we didn't want to write comprehensive guidance on ONS in that document. We tried to get our foot in by making the statement that ONS is made for each remedial action at the site, and that, you know, ONF triggers when each remedial action would then transfer. It doesn't say it any more directly than that right now, and we are going to have to figure out with attorneys whether we are able to say it more directly than that in future guidance. So there's not an easy answer, unfortunately. We're aware of the fact that certain states are pushing back. We've got some states that are claiming that they shouldn't have to take anything before goals are achieved, which would pretty much mean not taking anything ever, because there'd be nothing to take once the goal is achieved. And so there are just individual negotiations that we're going through, unfortunately, in each scenario.
Okay, and I guess that if we have foresight and write the rods more carefully in the future, perhaps the remedy can be analogous to the remedial action as you're using
it. But the more important thing, Mary Jane, I would say is actually the way your SFC is written. That really is the driver on who is responsible for what and when is your SFC. And so, you know, having the good foundation in the rod will make the SFC negotiation a little easier. I realize that in some states, SFC negotiation is just insanely painful. But that really is ideally where we would see who takes what when.
Right, but the issue comes up when you're trying to negotiate your SFC and they come back to the NCP language and say, we're not taking it until the remedy. So I appreciate that. The one guidance that I'm thinking of, I apologize, I can't remember the title of it right now, does have one sentence in it that says that a rod can include multiple remedial or multiple remedies, I think it says, because it tries to tie back to the NCP language. Is that still in place?
It should be, and that may be in Chapter 2 of this guidance, which I should know off the top of my head because I wrote it. There likely is a statement that a rod may have more than one. I know that we compiled a while ago some information on this, Mary Jane, because I know I was working with Emily Johnson for you guys on it, so I would have to look up.
We'll track it down. For the interest of your time now, thank you.
Yeah, we do need to move on. I don't want to, that was frustrating in these trainings because I know it triggers a ton of site-specific discussions. A lot of them are going to end up having to be things as we go through that we're probably going to need to have, you know, sidebar conversations on after the training, because we can't get too bogged down in site-specific things. But we will try to help you guys out on that, and then we will move on to see, are there other questions on the phone?
Yeah, if anybody else on the phone has a question, again, it's #6 to unmute. And if you have unmuted and you don't have a question, you can remute by hitting *6. And with that, I'm going to take a question that was submitted or as a comment online and just ask if you guys want to expand upon it. And this is coming in from Chicago. And they mention the need to better describe RAOs in a ROD as having a containment or restoration goal.
And they mentioned that this should make it much clearer when determining whether a component or project shifts from RA to O&M versus RNA to RA to LTRA and to O&M.
Yeah, that's definitely a great point. We don't get into it too much in this training. We do have some other training that we've delivered around to the regions on kind of the importance of restoration versus non-restoration, but really the reality of how you document, you know, when you determine it's time for RA completion and whether a remedy transitions to LTRA or not, or goes directly to O&M, really is a much easier determination to make if your RAOs are written clearly. Older rods are a particular problem for us. They're certainly getting better, but it really is the foundation of all of these issues. So.
And this is Kate, just to expand on that a little bit. As we move from our generic pump and treat remedies to our in-situ remedies, there's a lot of rods that are being written with a combination of source controls, slash source remediation, and restoration goals for in-situ actions. So just because you're injecting something into the groundwater doesn't necessarily mean that it's a restoration action. We may be treating DNAPL. So language in the rod to specify what the goal is for a certain remedial activity really plays a key role in what we're going to pay for and when it's going to go into LTRA or if it's even eligible for LTRA. An example I can think about is certain bioremediation remedies where we will do some bioaugmentation in a source area, knock down a certain amount of mass that will allow for M&A to occur for the dissolved phase plume. And some folks would just assume since the mass is in the groundwater that it is eligible for LTRA, but that's not the case. So we really encourage folks, because of the RA completion timing, that you look at what the objective of the action is that you're doing, because it will play a role on when you write your RA report.
All right. I think it is time to move on to the considerably easier topic of construction completion. So we are going to move on to slide 35. Actually, we can go ahead and jump to 36. So in the general flow of where we are in the guidance, we are going to start talking about construction completion now, which most of you probably know has been a key measure for the program for quite a while, and we will talk about the preliminary closeout report as the primary documentation of that. In a lot of ways, CC, construction completion is really, in my mind, so completely different than remedial action completion, and I think a lot of people try to equate them, and they really are so completely different. Site-wide, or construction completion is a site-wide measure, so on the one hand, the bar is much higher to achieve CC because you need to have completed construction of all of the remedies across your entire site, not anticipate anything further happening. On the other hand, the bar is kind of lower for CC because you're allowed to have punch list items linger after an inspection. You don't need to have achieved cleanup goals. And so really my best recommendation is to keep them separate in your mind and use the guidance to evaluate criteria when you're looking at completion of each of these milestones and really keep them separate so that you don't kind of get too confused about which one you're trying to follow. So moving on to 37. What's new about the 2011 guidance? There's not nearly as many substantial changes in this chapter as there were for RA. There are some additional details on criteria for in-situ remedies, which has already been a hot topic. And back after the last closeout procedures guidance, which was in 2000, there was an addendum to that guidance in 2005, which specified some details for in-situ. That has now been completely folded into this 2011 version and has been further kind of clarified so that it's clearer when you can get CC, and we'll talk about that in good detail. We also tried to clarify further, you know, when to anticipate kind of routine adjustments versus, you know, what is significant additional work that's planned that would make us, you know, a little apprehensive about declaring CC. And so, you know, what's the threshold there on what's reasonable to expect after CC and what would signal to us that CC is premature. And then, much like the RA completion, we did remove the requirement for cost information in the P-Corps along the same kind of lines of logic that it just was not the best source of the information. We really were only getting it for fund lead remedies, and so it wasn't complete. So moving on to 38, what is construction completion? A construction completion site is a CERCLA site where physical construction of all cleanup actions is complete, including actions to address all immediate threats and to bring all long-term threats under control. So this is the definition that today maybe isn't worded the best, but it was published in the Federal Register, so it's the one that we're stuck with. But the important thing to note here is that it's physical construction of all cleanup actions complete, and that long-term threats are under control, but not necessarily cleaned up. And so construction completion does not have to mean that you have achieved your cleanup goals across the site. 39, a little bit of background for construction completion. You know, this was originally first created back around 1990, I think, that we first created the designation for CC. And it was intended to demonstrate progress at sites prior to deletion from the MPL, trying to create kind of an interim milestone there to tell the public what was going on. It is strictly an internal EPA milestone. There is no legal, financial, or contractual significance to being construction complete unless for some reason you wrote that requirement into your own legal documentation in the region, but EPA does not consider that there is any significance to this milestone outside of the Superfund program. It is a site-wide measure, as I mentioned, and so eligibility is generally determined by the last response action at the site. And so as we're going through this module and we're talking about CC criteria for certain types of remedies, it's best to just remember that we're talking about the hypothetical where the remedy we're talking about is the last remedy. You basically need to think in your mind whether all of the remedies across your site have achieved the CC criteria for that type of remedy. So just to put it in perspective, we had achieved construction completion at 1,120 MPL sites as of the end of last year, and that's we've been running pretty steady at just over two-thirds of the MPL have been construction completion. For a long time, CC was the primary program measure that we were repeatedly asked about and beat up by Congress on. It has diminished some in visibility. It's no longer a strategic plan and GPRA target, but it is still a pretty important target and does go into our annual budget request. We do commit to a target still, so in a lot of ways it's just as much emphasis as there always has been. So. Moving on to slide 40. The basic process for construction completion consists of conducting your pre-final inspection of the last RA, reviewing the punch list items that come out of that inspection, and I realized today that I did not create a slide on punch list items, which is in a note to myself for the next time. So if you look in the guidance at Exhibit 3-1, there are a few examples of what we would consider to be maybe reasonable punch list items. You know, in general, work to demobilize, removing kind of construction debris and things, we would consider that to be punch list. The most, probably the number one issue that we are asked repeatedly about whether or not something counts as punch list is the vegetation issue. And we generally consider that if you are revegetating purely for aesthetic or landscaping reasons, say you're doing yards and you need to plant the rose bushes back that you dug up because you dug up somebody's yard, that would generally be considered acceptable as a punch list item because that landscaping is not integral to the remedy. If you're talking about vegetative cover on a cap, that is very likely not a punch list item, and we would need to talk about that. So so that example, that little box, Exhibit 3-1 in the guidance, has a few other examples on punch list items. So then after you've reviewed your punch list items and determined whether some of them are significant enough to need to be done prior to CC or can they linger, then you would take a look at the guidance and make sure you've reviewed the considerations for CC specifics to the remedial technology at your site, and then you would prepare your preliminary closeout report, and then we'll get into the process of reviewing and the headquarters role on the T-Corps. There may be very few instances, particularly nowadays, where construction completion could be documented with a final closeout report, and F-Corps, as you'll learn more from Kate, is used when all cleanup goals have been achieved at a site and you're moving towards deletion. We've had some sites in the past achieve CC with an F-Corps primarily if they were sites addressed completely and fully by the removal program. That doesn't happen too often nowadays, but it's always a possibility, so we leave it in there in the guidance. Moving on to 41, the guidance basically looks at specific considerations or criteria for construction completion kind of in these seven general categories that we're going to step through. So groundwater treatment, SCE, in-situ remedies for groundwater or soil, because here we're talking, we can lump in-situ together because the goal is not as important when it comes to CC as it does for RA. We'll talk about the implications of monitoring, ICs, interim remedies, and contingency remedies, and how all of these things kind of come into play when determining whether you're eligible for CC. Next, for slide 42, jumping right in to the first of kind of our technology areas. For basic groundwater treatment remedies, the CC guidelines are that physical construction of your treatment plant, your pumps, your extraction wells, all of the piping and such is complete. Your initial monitoring network has been installed, whether for M&A or any other groundwater remedy, that you've had your pre-final inspection and only have minor punch list items or no items remaining, that your treatment system has been turned on and you know that it is operational, and that expected future adjustments are likely to be minimal, that you're not expecting to have to go out and punch several more extraction wells a week later or something. And then the P-Corps should then identify your anticipated date of O&F and hopefully an estimated time frame to achieve cleanup goals. I realize that that last issue is a bit of a stretch at some remedies, but we do ask that it's in there in places that we feel we have a handle on that. So the O&F determination, the fact that we are saying here that in the O&F, that in the P-Corps, it can be identified as an anticipated date of O&F signifies that you do not have to have achieved O&F and certainly RA completion at the time of construction completion. Those two milestones may certainly lag after construction completion. Actually, the next example, if we go to 43, is a better example of that. And so for soil vapor extraction remedies, you know, drawing on what we learned in the RA completion module, you would be RA complete after the period of operation of your soil vapor extraction system where you achieve cleanup goals in the soil. And so your RA completion would be a few years likely down the line that your SVE has been operating. If SVE was your only remedy or your last remedy, you would be construction complete at the time you built that remedy and turned it on and knew that it was operational. And so that's the most common scenario to be able to demonstrate why O&F and RA completion may lag behind CC. So I know we do get some questions here that, I can't target my site for CC because my RA, my last RA isn't complete yet. And they really do not have to go hand in hand like that. So let's see, SCE, extraction network and treatment unit has been constructed. You, again, have done your pre-final inspection and have only your minor punch list items. The system is operational and your future adjustments are minimal. And again, that you have your anticipated date of O&F and achieving cleanup goals in the timeline of future activities in the P-Corps. Moving on to 44. In situ remedies for groundwater and soil. So there is a pretty substantial section to the May 2011 guidance on this. I absolutely encourage people to read it and maybe reread it a few times. This is an area that we tried to clarify, and I think a lot of people, hopefully, who have remedies with in-situ or have sites with in-situ remedies, hopefully will learn that they may be eligible for CC sooner than they expect. That's my hope. as the person who's responsible for managing the CC number, that's my hope. So basically what is stressed in the guidance on in-situ remedies, and again, this now, moving away from RA completion, we're talking in-situ for either groundwater or soil because we're talking only about the physical installation of the remedy regardless of the goal when it comes to construction completion. It is important for CC that you are talking about the full-scale remedy, that the full-scale remedy is underway, you're no longer in a pilot phase, you're no longer doing treatability studies, you need to have begun implementation of the full-scale remedy. And recognizing that in-situ remedies in most cases really are implemented in phases across the site. The guidance highlights the most common example of, you know, you may do a round or two of injections in a source area, wait a little bit to see exactly what the impacts are before you decide, you know, how spaced out or what your time plan is for attacking the dissolved area. And so this is the important part that this guidance clarifies, is that when we talk about CC criteria for in situ, if you have phases planned like that, your site's CC criteria apply to the first phase. You do not have to be all the way through to the last phase of your planned in-situ remedy to declare a CC. You can hopefully declare it at the point in time of the first phase. And so the three main criteria are the next three bullets. Physical construction of at least that first phase of the full-scale remedy is complete. So if you are installing injection wells, piping, and metering systems to be delivering your reagents underground, if part of your remedy does include pump and treat because you're recirculating or something, all of that physical construction would need to be complete for the first phase. At least one round of treatment or injection has been initiated for the full-scale remedy. So basically, that means if you're doing ISCO, you need to have injected your first shot of oxidant. If you're doing steam, you need to have turned on the system and started generating the steam. If it's ERH, you need to have started your electrodes and started the heating process. And then the last is that a pre-final inspection indicates that the remedy is going to perform as designed and your future adjustments are minimal again, like other remedies. I'm going to go ahead and pause and allow questions specific to the in-situ scenario if anybody has some, because I know it's a tricky issue.
Again, if you're on the phone line, you're welcome to take yourself off of mute. Feel free to ask a question if you have one. If you're streaming the audio online, I did have a comment that came in, and I'll go ahead and take that one if you're going to pause right now. And this question, or is more a comment, that ICs are considered an action remedy and are also not listed as a, quote, minor punch list item. However, we don't hold off taking the P-Corps credit. I assume this practice will remain.
That is correct, and we're going to touch on that in two more slides. So, good comment. All right. Well, I am pleased that there are no specific questions on the in-situ. Obviously, we'll pause for questions again at the end if anything comes up. But hopefully the guidance is clearer on this issue, and certainly as site-specific issues come up, you can get in touch with us. So slide 45, groundwater monitoring. The need for monitoring certainly doesn't preclude considering a site for construction completion. For M&A remedies, we basically ask that the initial network of monitoring wells should be in place prior to CC, since there's not a lot of, you know, really any other physical construction that happens for M&A. We just need to make sure that we can effectively say that we are doing the M part of the M&A at the time of CC. And basically, the installation of monitoring wells is generally considered, you know, whether it's a punch list item or just an acceptable routine adjustment after CC. really because groundwater remedies obviously are very dynamic in nature in terms of how the system shifts as your remedy is operating, and so there's always going to be a need to change the location and add some new monitoring wells, and so we don't consider the installation of new monitoring wells to inhibit declaring CC credit. 46 touches on the IC issue. Since ICs require no physical construction, we do allow them to lag after construction completion. What we ask is that the P-Corps be clear that ICs are planned, that we very much would like to see that they already are documented in a decision document at the time of CC. We don't really like the idea of new decision documents coming up too much after construction completion. So hopefully ICs are already documented in a decision document. And then the P-Corps should highlight what those ICs, you know, what did we select in the ROD, and what is the timeline for implementing those ICs. And so they should be in the schedule of activities for site completion, which I'll highlight as one of the P-Corps sections. The important thing to note, of course, is that ICs do have to be implemented for site completion, which Kate will talk about, but for CC, it is okay that they are not in place. But I would not necessarily call them a punch list item. They're just really a separate issue. Slide 47 touches on interim remedies. The use of interim remedies has kind of ebbed and flowed over the years. My understanding is they're kind of on the rise again these days. The use of interim remedies as it applies to construction completion criteria is basically that any interim ROD or interim remedy needs to have been followed by the final ROD and implementation then of that final remedy before the site qualifies as CC. So basically, at the time of your P-Corps and construction completion determination, there should not still be an interim ROD on the books that has not been addressed by a final ROD. And so that has been an issue a few times in the past, and so that is an important issue for us because we do not want to anticipate ROD amendments and things coming after CC. 48 touches on kind of a related issue of contingency remedies, which also seems to be increasingly common, particularly, you know, certainly with respect to groundwater, where maybe we selected in situ or M&A, and then we have a pump and treat contingency on the books and the ROD, and we really can't declare comfortably construction completion at that site until we can say that we don't anticipate having to build that pump and treat system. This is definitely becoming an issue for more and more sites where we've written into the ROD that we will monitor for M&A for a strict 5-year period before we rule out pump and treat, and so we're kind of held to that period before we can declare construction completion. Basically, what needs to happen with contingency remedies, if you have a ROD with a contingency remedy that requires physical construction, in order to declare CC, you need to have enough information to comfortably make a statement in the P-Corps that at the time of the P-Corps, you do not anticipate having to invoke that contingency remedy. Because CC is not any kind of legal determination, a P-Corps is not a decision document, it doesn't preclude us from invoking that contingency later, but this is a situation where, you know, we need to make the best professional judgment at the time that we do not anticipate needing that contingency. Slide 49. The next two slides touch on different issues specific to leads at sites and other cleanup programs. And so for PRP lead sites and for fellow facilities, the criteria for achieving construction completion are exactly the same as for private sites. There's no difference in any of the criteria that we would evaluate. And for PRP lead sites, and really for fellow facilities, we just stress that, again, the CC declaration should not affect any enforcement agreements or any other obligations. When it comes to fellow facilities, the guidance does clarify a little more in this version that we really, our preference is for the EPA RPM to write the P-Corps at federal facility sites. that tends to keep them a lot more concise than if the other federal agency's contractor writes them. We've had some federal facility PCORs that are upwards of 200 pages that are just way more detailed than we need. It obviously takes a considerable length of time to develop that document, when really, for most of these federal facilities, acknowledging that they are more complicated than private sites for the most part, but we really don't need that length of documentation. We would prefer something much more compact. Gets to the point.
Streamlined.
So that is a new facet of the guidance that we really do encourage the EPA RPM to write the PCOR for federal facilities. For all sites, but it was generally already happening that way for private sites. So slide 50, state lead sites. I know some regions in particular have an abundance of state lead sites. In those instances, if the state, you know, has a lead on the ROD and all of the actions at the site, we would generally be looking for them to write their preliminary closeout report as well with EPA review and concurrence on the document. If for some reason the state pushes back and, you know, because CC is our milestone and they don't seem to want to take the time to write a PCOR, then we do need the EPA RPM to write the document. Previous guidance and procedures allow construction completion with other forms of documentation, but current practice, it has to be a PCOR or an FCOR if appropriate. So we can't just take a casual two-page memo from the state. We would need the EPA RPM to step in and write that PCOR in that situation. Looking at sites addressed by removal, I touched on this a little bit at the very start of our session. We don't have many sites nowadays that are addressed entirely by removal. If you do have one of those, CC is likely, can be documented at the same time with a poll rep with a final closeout report, so you'd be moving towards deletion at the same time as CC. If you have a site that had removal actions but was not removal only strictly, then really there are no changes to your process. You would describe your removal actions in the PCOR similar to how you describe your remedial actions, and all of your criteria would still apply. You know, presumably after removal, hopefully you don't really have punch list items and things like that anyway, but the same criteria across the board would apply to those removals. And then multiple authorities. Some of these sites, particularly if they're still active, operating facilities or larger facilities that maybe have actions underway covered by RCRA, NRC, or some other authority, because CC is an EPA milestone, it only, our criteria only apply to actions selected under CERCLA. So if, you know, we had a ROD to do certain actions under CERCLA and all of that is complete, but RCRA is in there doing some small work on some completely separate part of the facility, we would likely be able to declare CC in that situation because the CERCLA work was complete. We did have to read this section of the guidance in quite detail in the previous version for a site in the last couple of years where DOE was doing some non-CERCLA work at a site that was pretty substantial, but we ultimately did take CC credit for that site because all of the CERCLA work, in fact, was complete. So. Slide 51. This also is a little bit of a rare situation, but worth mentioning that originally when we created the construction completion milestone, it applied only to final NPL sites because at the time it probably never occurred to folks that there'd be a reason to need to declare it at a deleted site. But there are some sites that get deleted from the NPL based on deferral to the RCRA program. And at the time of deferral and such, at the time of deletion from the NPL, physical construction may not be done because we've deferred the work, basically, to the RCRA program. That basically would have meant that those sites were deleted, but they were not construction complete. So the policy was changed that we can now declare CC a deleted site. It's a very small number of sites that are affected by this. But it does basically mean that in the chronology of a site, you would be deleted prior to construction completion. And so it's just, the guidance covers that that is, while unlikely, it is a viable scenario. slide 52. The issue of additional work at CC sites is something that's coming up more and more as headquarters is evaluating, reviewing draft PCORs and evaluating eligibility of sites, depending on what type of work may still happen after construction completion. So the guidance expands on this a little bit to clarify that routine adjustments should be expected, obviously, in the dynamic nature of all of the work that we do, and they don't preclude declaring construction completion. There's a laundry list of examples in the guidance in Chapter 3, and it touches on things like repairs and maintenance and new monitoring wells, certainly. Building repairs, removing, phases of a treatment train because it's no longer needed, things like that. The tricky issue becomes when is CC premature because you don't envision just those routine adjustments, you envision more substantial construction. If we get a PCOR in that says, oh, by the way, we just kicked off a VI evaluation and we don't know yet what's going to happen, but the remedy on the books right now is complete, that raises a red flag to us because it means there may be a new pathway, there may be a new remedy that we need to address, and so CC would likely be premature. The guidance specifies that if a new ROD or a new ROD amendment is anticipated with a fundamental change planned, that would likely make CC premature. ESDs, depending on what issue they're addressing, may make us a little uncomfortable as well, so we talk through those sites specifically as they come up. So, and then there's kind of this third category of no matter how well we did our job, stuff happens after CC. You may get hit by a hurricane and you may have significant work that comes, and that too can be reasonably expected and is unfortunate, but significant work may happen after construction completion, the key here being unforeseen circumstances that trigger that work. The guidance allows that headquarters in the region will evaluate whether the site retains its CC status. We have never un-CC'd a site, but we don't want to say that we never would. We do have sites that have significant work underway, particularly as MCLs and things like that change, and we have to go back out and do work. Stuff unfortunately does happen, but really the threshold for all of these discussions that happen at the time of CC is kind of what did you know and when did you know it? What can you reasonably anticipate in order to determine whether the timing is right to declare construction completion? So, slide 53. Looking at the preparation, approval, and distribution of the PCOR, I mentioned that the PCOR is typically prepared by the EPA RPM. It is, for private sites, we say in general 7 to 9 pages covering the entire site, up to 20 for federal facilities, which I realize is still extremely tight for some of how large our federal facilities are, but it's really just our way of trying to stress that we do not want the 3 binders from the Army's contractor as the PCOR. and then the, again, stressing that the PCOR can come prior to RA report signature for your final RA projects. The timing there really is completely separate between RA and CC. The approval process on a PCOR, most of you probably know, is very different from a lot of other documents. Because of the fact that CC is a key measure, headquarters does have final concurrence on taking credit for the measure. And so basically what happens is that as RPMs draft the PCOR, it's sent to headquarters for review, whether it's to me or to your regional coordinator within the construction and post-construction branch. And upon reviewing the initial draft, headquarters will help determine whether, you know, the site really is eligible. Are there any issues that we didn't foresee, things like that, that impact construction completion. And then we will basically give kind of our staff-level informal concurrence on the final draft. If we have comments and we send them back, we may, depending on the nature of them, ask to see the next version, because once that document is signed, we don't want any surprises once the division director has signed to PCOR. So we want to make sure that basically before signature, headquarters has already given the okay for the document to move through the signature chain. The P Corps should be signed at the DD level, which is higher than the RA report that we talked about earlier, but lower than deletion. And then when the document is signed, the document should be sent to us as a scanned PDF, ideally, or fax, if anybody still does that. And we then, primarily me, if I'm out, there's a few other people that will go into Circlist and flip the flag to officially declare construction. The date of CC is officially the date that the document is signed, even if it takes a few days for that document to get to us and flip the flag. It will, in Circlist, be backdated as the official CC date. It's the date of the signature. And again, it's retained in the region in site files and shared with natural resource trustees if appropriate. Slide 54 is the outline of the P Corps. If you're following along in the guidance, it's Exhibit 3-2, which has more detail on the sections. We did not make many changes to this outline other than again, removing the section on costs for implementing the remedy, since it was causing a lot of heartburn to generate that and wasn't really giving us much value. The schedule of activities for site completion is an important area. We want to see there that, you know, we have the planned ONF dates, we have, you know, maybe LTRA transfer, we have the five-year review, you know, the, whatever the next scheduled five-year review is, hopefully a general estimate of when cleanup goals will be achieved, things like that, and then who is responsible and what's the timeline for each of those activities. And slide 65 is back to our little scenario. Construction completion, when we would be complete for each of these OUs and looking at the site-wide CC measure, we would want to make sure that for the soil remedy, everything was excavated and removed off-site, that the, you know, if you have a big gaping hole, we've backfilled it with new dirt, and we've done the pre-final inspection. In terms of punch list items, again, we may be okay with some, you know, minor landscaping for aesthetic purposes and some demob would potentially be okay there, you know, if necessary. And then for groundwater, we would need to have installed all of our wells, you know, a treatment system if it's related to that ISCO, any piping and things like that. We would need the first injection to have been done for the full-scale remedy for that ISCO, and then we would need the initial monitoring wells in place for M&A for the initial rounds of monitoring. And additional injections, obviously, could continue after construction completion, and we could go in and install new monitoring wells if necessary. And then the ICs would not need to be implemented, but we would want to make sure that they were described in the P Corps and that they appear on the list of activities that are needed for completion. And it's time for questions, and then a voice break for me.
Again, if you're on the phone, it's #6 to unmute your line. And feel free to identify yourself and region and ask your question.
Hi, can I ask a question? This is Ellie Hale from Region 10.
Sure.
So this may be fundamental, but it seems like if you have a series of phased construction actions and the construction completion report happens when you've done them all and the RA reports happen by OU, how do you document sort of the construction completion sort of the as-built situation for the different phases? What is that separate RA report, even though the RA report is by OU? You know, I think I have more phases than I have OU, is what I'm trying to say.
I'm not sure that I'm exactly following the question. So the construction completion, if it happens, you're questioning it happening prior to those RA reports being done?
No. I'm just saying that it sounds like there's sometimes when you want to document some construction work with as-built, but it's not one of these milestones. It's not a construction completion and it's not an RA report. Is there a term that we have or a process that we have separate from these? Because it seems like you could have, you know, construction in multiple phases, a cap and a water treatment system, and you don't, maybe if they're all part of the OU, you don't have it all done at once, and therefore, I guess my question is, how would you make sure that, you know, the appropriate documentation is there before the contractor who did the soil work is gone and then...
Mm-hmm. So is your question, generally we have the contractor write the RA report when they're done with some activities. Are you asking a question where, say I have one contractor building a pump and treat system and doing an excavation, and you want to break it into two projects, but you're only going to have one RA report when both things are done? Is the question, how do you achieve RA complete at like the pump and treat system? If you're not writing the RA report until the soil excavation's done?
Yeah, that's kind of not my question. I think my question is probably one that's kind of a practical, local question, and I'll just drop it.
Yeah, I mean, I think the simple answer, if I'm understanding the question, is that that should be documented in the RA report. So
yeah, as-built or an appendices.
Yeah, then an as-built, they are mentioned as one of the items, potential items, as an appendix to the RA report. If you look in, it's in Chapter 2, Exhibit 2-5 for the RA report contents. I mean, because the RA report is going to be specific for each remedial action, then you wouldn't hopefully, you know, assuming that the RAs are scoped kind of to an appropriate size where you don't have, you wouldn't have contractors coming and going and kind of losing knowledge because you'd have an RA report for each phase of that implementation of that remedy. And so they would hopefully capture that information before, you know, walking away into, you know, the Netherlands. So,
okay. Thank you. I think that does answer that question.
Okay.
But I'll save it for later.
Any other questions on the phone? Again, #6 to unmute your line. Okay, we did have a question that came in online, and that question asks, would it be adequate to apply the groundwater monitoring criteria for a portion of a remedy at a sediment site where the remedy is MNA in order to claim a CC?
Okay, so that is talking about monitor natural recovery. That's what the R is.
Yeah.
MNR for sediments. I think, yes, basically... for construction completion for sediment remedy, if your remedy is monitoring, you basically would need to, you know, gotten out there and basically started your monitoring, pinpointed where your MNR, you know, your monitoring points are, that kind of thing. Because there's really no physical construction associated with that type of action, so.
Okay, great. Okay, I think we're going to continue on with the training, and this is just a quick time check. It's about 2:45, so we have about 1 hour and 15 minutes to go through the rest of the slides. And I think we're going to resume the training on slide 57. If you did unmute, please remute with *6.
All right, this is Kate Gruffy. I'm going to be doing the next two sections, Chapter 4, Site Completion, and Chapter 5, Deletion. You could go to the next slide, Jane. So we've talked about remedial action completion and construction completion. We're now moving on to site completion. And just as a frame of reference, Jen said earlier that we have about over 1,100 sites that are construction complete, and we really only have 360 sites that have reached the site completion milestone. So the time frame between construction completion and site completion for a majority of the sites may be a long one. We can move to the next slide. So let's start with what's new with the 2011 guidance. What we tried to do in this Chapter 4, which is pretty short, is to provide more detail on site completion criteria. Again, site completion is really the F-Core, is the document for site completion, and really starts the whole deletion process. So the F-Core and the site completion criteria is really the crux of being able to get off the MPL. The F-Core section was modified. We added some additional language to discuss confirmatory sampling results for source remediation and also source and groundwater containment activities. And as Jen alluded to before, in the old 2000 guidance for RA complete for groundwater and surface water restoration remedies, we had an interim RA report that was done when physical construction was complete, and then we anticipated that a final closeout report would be written when the restoration, surface water groundwater restoration action had achieved its goals. We found that for the few sites that have actually reached those goals, we really weren't getting a final remedial action report. It was really just documented in a final operation and maintenance report that was provided by the contractor that was doing the work at that time. So we decided that instead of having that final RA report requirement and then trying to figure out who would write it, the state's contractor, EPA, et cetera, we would just have a section in the F-Corps that summarized all the activities that were done for that restoration action from the RA complete to the site completion. Next slide. So what is site completion? Site completion is the end of all response actions at an MPL site. A response action, by definition, is any action that is taken to achieve a remedial action objective and associated cleanup level. So O&M is not considered a response action, so you can be at the site completion milestone and still have O&M requirements. Next slide, please. So these site completion criteria are the ones that I referenced that were modified from the original 2000 guidance. The 2000 guidance pretty much said site completion criteria is that the site is protective. That still is the fundamental criteria, that the response actions that were taken have made the site protective of human health and the environment. But to expand on that, we have these three bullets. I'm going to talk about the bullets in the next slides. The first bullet is that all remedial decision documents have been completed and the selected remedy or remedies is consistent with CERCLA, the NCP, and EPA policy and guidance. The second bullet is that response actions are complete and appropriately documented, and finally, ICs are in place. Next slide, please. So we'll go to that first bullet, which I find to be one of the most loaded bullets I've ever written because it says so many things in one sentence. So let's talk about what that sentence means. The first part of it is that all remedial decision documents have been completed. The expectation is that all the remedial actions that have been done at a site on the MPL are documented in a decision document. That would be a record of decision, ROD amendment, ESD, et cetera. What we also tried to do with this statement was to also encourage folks to document all other activities that were performed at a site under another entity, maybe a state authority or removal. We encouraged that these activities be evaluated in a CERCLA decision document to ensure that they're protective of human health and the environment, so really going through the nine criteria analysis. And finally, for sites where we did an RIFS and found that there was no risk for human health or the environment, that we did a no action or no further action record of decision. The second part of this is that the selected remedy is consistent with CERCLA, the NCP, and EPA policy and guidance. What we meant here is that for all the investigation that was done at the site, a response action was taken to address all unacceptable human health and ecological risks that were identified at the site through the RFS or any other site investigation, baseline screening for ecological risk, et cetera. The other thing that this is looking at is, especially for a lot of our older rods, when we weren't as savvy with remedial action objectives and cleanup goals, we'll have rods that it's very hard to figure out exactly what the goal was or the end point. So what we do is we take those decisions and we apply them to what the expectations are for protectiveness per CERCLA, the NCP, and EPA policy and guidance. So that's not looking at, say, a record of decision written in 1985 and saying, oh, is it consistent with the ROD guidance? It's looking at the elements of the decision and ensuring that they are protective and consistent with ARRs as appropriate. The best example is groundwater remedies. There's a 2009 groundwater policy that discusses the expectations for groundwater remediation and restoration, that any actual or potential drinking water aquifer should be restored to MCLs. If MCLs are not, restoration is not practical, you have to do an AROR waiver. So if we get a groundwater remedy or a site that comes in for site completion and has a potential or current drinking water aquifer but did not select a remedy to restore to MCLs or data indicates that groundwater is still contaminated and there is a plume above MCLs, we would state, although the record of decision did not choose a remedy, the site is not protective and consistent with CERCLA and the MCP for the expectations of protectiveness in the groundwater arena. Also, for institutional controls, a lot of the older decision documents did not envision the use of institutional controls. So if you have a law that was written in 1986 for a landfill cap and you don't have ICs on it, before we would delete a site from the MPL and meet the site completion criteria, we would want the IC to be documented in a decision document. So that's what the first bullet means. Next slide. Okay, all response actions have been completed and appropriately documented in the site file. What we're looking for here is that any response action, regardless if it's a source remediation action, a groundwater restoration action, or a containment action, that there's defensible and reportable data to verify the cleanup levels in the ROD have been achieved. We've run into issues lately at the site completion milestone where there may be some excavation work that was done under removal and never evaluated under a ROD, where there was never confirmatory sampling done to show that any cleanup goal was achieved, and in some cases, there were no cleanup goals. So what we're looking for here is that any action that was taken can be defensively argued to be protective of human health and the environment and has the data to show that. For removals, we're looking for pull reps, and then for RA reports for remedial actions that Jen talked about in excruciating detail earlier. All right, next. And then finally, institutional controls are in place. All ICs must be implemented before site completion. When the whole IC initiative happened about 10 years ago, we found that a lot of sites that had reached a site completion slash deletion milestone didn't have ICs, so there was an immediate, urgency to put ICs in decision documents at sites that were at the site completion deletion milestone, so we make sure that they're there now. ICs, in general, should be considered for all response actions that leave waste in place above levels that allow for unlimited use and unrestricted exposure, and to beat a dead horse, ICs should be in a CERCLA decision document. Next, please. I hit on this a little bit earlier, the role of operation and maintenance activities in achieving site completion. When a site completion milestone has been met, meaning all remedial action objectives and cleanup goals have been met, O&M activities can continue to maintain the engineering and or IC sites where waste is left in place. Of course, if you reach a site completion milestone where you've cleaned up all source material and or groundwater contamination to allow for unrestricted use, O&M is not going to be necessary. Next slide, please. So, as I alluded to before, the final closeout report has changed a little bit compared to the 2000 guidance. The revised outlines exhibit 4.3 in the closeout procedures. Introduction and summary of site conditions is pretty generic. As I alluded to before, Section 3 is monitoring results, and this is the data that we were discussing to demonstrate that source remediation has been achieved and those cleanup levels are documented, and also that you have data to show that any containment activities, whether it be physical containment like a landfill cap or hydraulic containment like a groundwater pump and treat, has met the goals and objectives of the ROD. The next section is Section 4, which is the attainment of groundwater restoration cleanup levels, if applicable. This is, of course, if you don't have a groundwater restoration remedy, you wouldn't need this section. This is the information that I alluded to before that would be in a final RA report from the old guidance. It's all the data and activities that have been done from the RA report to achieving the groundwater restoration cleanup levels. So it would have O&M reports, it would talk about any optimizations that were done, and would really make the defensible argument that you have met groundwater cleanup levels throughout the plume based on your record of decision. The next section is a summary of operation and maintenance, and this is only going to be the operation and maintenance activities that are going to be necessary in perpetuity once you've deleted the site from the MPL. So this is going to be for any containment activity or waste that's been left in place. The next section is the demonstration of cleanup activity QA/QC, and this is pretty generic. That talks about QA from mostly the operation and maintenance and data collection phases that were done during the operation of the remedy. The section after that is the five-year review. In this section, we're going to want to talk about what the last five, you're going to talk about which type of five-year review is necessary, whether it's a policy review or a statutory review. You're also going to want to talk about the results of the last five-year review, and if there were any issues and recommendations, you're going to want to talk about the actions that were taken to address them to ensure that really all your I's are dotted and your T's are crossed before you achieve site completion. And then Section 8 is the site completion criteria, which really is just a formal statement that you've achieved protectiveness and completed all your response actions. You can go to the next slide. So for a final closeout report, the preparation is the same as that for the P-Corps for construction completion. It's typically prepared by the RPM. Again, the information that is used to generate the F-Corps, you can generally use a lot of the background information from the P-Corps, and you're going to want to use a lot of your confirmation sampling results from your RA reports and any groundwater or surface water restoration data from O&M reports to justify the attainment of restoration objectives. The length, again, is going to be maybe a little bit longer than the P-Corps, especially if you're going to have restoration discussion of attainment of restoration, because not only are you going to want to have that justification that you've met that goal, but you're also generally going to want to append O&M reports to support that statement. The approval, you send it to the EPA headquarters regional coordinator for review. We do not have concurrence on the final closeout report, but we do have, we do require review. The final closeout report is signed by the regional administrator or the designated official. When I talk about EPA headquarters coordinators reviewing them but not having concurrence on them, I would recommend that you really work with your coordinator to ensure that the final closeout report has all the information necessary to justify site completion, because the information that goes, we structured the final closeout report to easily feed the deletion notices that we're going to talk about in the next section. So if you work, go back and forth with your headquarters coordinator and generally myself to make sure that all the information is in the final closeout report, it's going to make the preparation of the deletion documentation much easier. And then for distribution, again, headquarters does not retain the final closeout reports here like we do for the P-Corps. They're maintained at the site, and again, you're going to notify your natural resource trustees when it is signed. Next, please. So I went through that pretty quick, and I'll take questions in a second. But we're going to revisit our training scenario. This is the last time that we're going to revisit it because we've met the almighty site completion milestone. So again, let's go back to the single site-wide rod for the soil. We had an excavation and off-site disposal, and for groundwater, we had the ISCO and M&A with some ICs. So for site completion, when we're reviewing documentation, we would go back and look at the rod and look at the activities for the soil excavation and ensure that the excavation was completed and confirmatory sampling was taken and documented, and we would also make sure that the cleanup levels that were chosen in the rod for the soils are still protective of human health and the environment, given the assumptions that were used during the risk assessment and the development of the cleanup numbers. For the groundwater, we would make sure that all of the contaminants of concern had reached the MCLs or cleanup levels that were protective of the beneficial use, which generally MCLs. We would make sure that all data for all monitoring wells showed that each contaminant of concern had met MCLs. We would want to see the justification and documentation in the F-Corps. Since the institutional controls were going to be limited for well drilling while the restoration was occurring, the ICs don't need to be in place in order to demonstrate site completion. They could be removed at this point. I'm just going to note here that for interim institutional controls that are needed during an action that will eventually be lifted if you've reached groundwater restoration or maybe some sort of surface water restoration, we don't require that you remove the IC before we reach site completion, but we want you to document in the EPCOR that the ICs are no longer necessary in order to be protective of human health and the environment for the remediation that was done at this site. So in this scenario, the implementation of the ICs is less important since I'm assuming waste is not left in place. So we would be, in essence, once we were done with this, walking away and not having any O&M or five-year review requirements. So that's all I have for that. So we'll move to the next slide. I know that was quick and full of a lot of information, so if anyone has any questions, please ask away.
Pound six to unmute.
Yeah, can we go back to slide 65 for just a second? This is Tim in Region 10.
Sure.
So,
slide 65.
65, yeah, it seems to me that bullets 1 and 2 could be somewhat in conflict if, in fact, you have ICs that say, for example, you have a containment remedy and it says ICs to prevent wells and exposure to contaminated groundwater remaining at the site. Those are never going away. So the first one says that's O&M, but since you have, I mean, I guess I'm not saying this well, but basically those ICs are necessary to achieve your RAOs, and they're necessary in perpetuity to achieve your RAOs. So if I look at these two bullets, that suggests to me I don't reach site completion.
Okay, let me see if I can help. Okay, O&M, if you've achieved REOs and cleanup levels at a site where O&M is necessary, then you've left waste in place.
Yeah.
Right? So you would need ICs in perpetuity, and you'd need any engineering controls that you have to contain that material.
Right, and arguably those are to meet RAOs. Because remedial action to stay there.
But what we're saying here is that you've met the REO and the ICs are there to maintain the protectiveness of that remedy.
But again, some here would interpret that as that's an RAO. And so the way the second bullet is written, if you take that interpretation that you only, you need them to continue to meet the RAO, then this slide would suggest you don't qualify for completion when I think you're intending to say you do.
Yeah, I think the first bullet's saying if you have waste left in place and you've met your goals, you can have O&M. If you're doing activities and haven't met your goal yet, which it would be maybe a restoration or some sort of monitored natural recovery for sediments, then you haven't met your goal yet. That's really what the two bullets are saying. That you can have O&M if you've met all the goals in your rod. If you are doing O&M in order to achieve the goals in your rod, then site completion is premature. So if I'm doing operation and maintenance to restore an aquifer and I haven't restored it yet, site completion is premature. But
no,
if
I'm saying you've got a situation where you've got an RAO that says prevent exposure to the stuff left in place. So that's a continuing effort to meet RAOs, arguably.
Okay. No, I understand what you're saying. That was not the intent of the bullet, but I'll clarify that bullet.
Appreciate it. And it could come up later. I think I know what you want, but I was struggling with the language.
Okay.
This is Vincent, Article 6. Hi, the scenario where you have groundwater restoration and the ICs are no longer needed, wouldn't that also fall into the category of, say, the treatment plant itself? Where the system is no longer needed, you want to remove that equipment, the tanks, and anything else, and the ICs would fall into place as well. So wouldn't that be part of that effort to remove the action itself so that you can delete the site or close it out?
Generally, for an engineered remedy, we would like to see that remedy dismantled and removed. Sometimes with monitoring wells and ICs, which, we don't really have authority over, we have authority over the monitoring wells, but for the ICs, sometimes certain entities would like to keep that IC in place. We can't force someone to remove the IC. We can declare under CERCLA that it's no longer necessary, but if that entity wants to keep the IC in place for some other reason, we're not going to hold up site completion because that entity doesn't want to remove the institutional control. But clarification that it's no longer necessary for the CERCLA response would occur.
Okay.
Likewise, for monitoring wells, if it's a fund lead site and the state's doing O&M and they want to keep the wells there for some other purpose, we're not going to make them pull all the wells in order to get site completion. But the documentation is that we, EPA, no longer require them for the CERCLA response.
Great. Thank you.
Yep.
Okay. I don't see any other questions online. One last call for questions on the phone. Okay. With that, we'll go ahead and resume the presentation. If you did unmute your line, we would ask that you remute by hitting star 6. And we're going to resume the session on slide number 70.
Okay. You can go to 71. Okay. We are on the last chapter, site deletion. Deletion is really, in all essence, an administrative requirement of removing a site or, in the case of partial deletions, portions of a site from the MPL. So a lot of the legwork is really done at the site completion milestone of working with us to make sure that you have the documentation required in your F-4 to show that you've met the site completion milestone. So deletion is really just going to be a lot of administrative things. The site completion criteria is really the basis for the site deletion. So let's go to the next slide. So what's new in the 2011 guidance? The 2000 guidance had deletions and partial deletions in separate chapters. So for purposes of being streamlined, we combined them. The 2000 guidance also had some GPS mapping requirements for partial deletions. And as we moved forward with the partial deletion process, we found that that ended up being a nightmare, really. We were getting GPS mapping that wasn't even within the site proper, so we really just require now a map. It discusses deletion notices and provides a link to templates. The templates were developed a couple years ago for all types of deletion notices for the Federal Register. In 2009, I believe, we sent out a memorandum that required headquarters concurrence on deletion and partial deletion, and really we modified the delegation of authority that requires it. There's also an electronic docket requirement. It's called the Federal Docket Management System that I'll talk about later. And then also, when doing a rulemaking in the Federal Register, there's two different processes, the traditional and direct process. I'm going to talk about both of those. So the deletion chapter really is a lot more robust than it was in the 2000 guidance. Next slide, please. Okay, so what is a deletion? A deletion is an administrative action, as I said before, that is the removal of a site or the partial deletion portion of a site from the national priorities list. So it's really removing or recharacterizing the site and going from final MPL status to deleted. Next slide, please. So the process, as I said before, generally begins at most sites when the F-Corps is signed. The deletion requirements include documentation of activities and decision-making at the site is complete, which in essence is your F-Corps. The activities are documented and verified, which is your deletion docket, and the public has an opportunity for notice and comment before the site is formally deleted from the MPL. And this is the Federal Register process. Next slide. So partial deletions, there was a rule in the Federal Register in 1995. It says that EPA may delete portions of MPL sites provided that the deletion criteria are met for these portions. We require that media or portions of the site being deleted be clearly delineated in a map, generally, or it's described in the deletion notice if it's a media like groundwater or surface soils. And the deletion action does not interrupt ongoing removal or remedial actions at other portions of the site. The reason that the partial deletion FR publication came out was because of the Superfund reforms, and it was thought that partial deletion of sites from the MPL would sort of spur redevelopment. And we haven't really seen a correlation between partial deletions and redevelopment. A lot of the partial deletions that we see coming through are at federal facilities or very large sites. Some regions like to use partial deletions to sort of demonstrate progress, so as they complete remedial actions or geographical areas in a large complex site that might have 9 or 10 operable units. They like to generally delete operable units or actions as they complete them in order to show some progress. Federal facilities do the same thing. We have seen a couple partial deletions that are done for redevelopment, but again, there's really no one-to-one correlation. Next slide, please. So deletion criteria. The NCP states that a site may be deleted when no response or no further response is appropriate, and EPA must consult with the state in making this determination. That's pretty straightforward. Next, please. So the NCP says that EPA must determine, in consultation with the state, that one of the following criteria have been met. The responsible parties or other parties have implemented all appropriate response actions. The fund under CERCLA has implemented all appropriate response actions. No further response is appropriate. Or the remedial investigation has shown that there's no unacceptable risk. Therefore, no remedial action is necessary. And this is really documenting that in a no further action or no action ROD. Next. As Jen alluded to before in the construction completion chapter, there is a policy for RCRA deferral, a deletion policy for RCRA deferral. It was originally put in the Federal Register in 95 and then updated in 1997 to include federal facility sites. We only have, I think, 7 or 8 RCRA deferral deletions, and the purpose of this policy in the Federal Register was that a lot of sites early on, in the early 80s, were listed on the MPL when RCRA didn't have the authority to address off-site contamination. When the hazardous solid waste amendments were implemented, it allowed RCRA to address off-site contamination. So some of the sites on the MPL really had this duplication of RCRA and CERCLA authority. Originally, they were to have RCRA address the facility and then have CERCLA address the off-site contamination. But now that RCRA could do all of these under their enforceable permits, it made sense to remove the duplication of effort and defer these sites to RCRA. Next slide, please. So the criteria for a RCRA deferral are that the CERCLA site is being addressed under a RCRA corrective action authority under an existing enforceable order or permit, the response is progressing adequately, and deletion does not disrupt ongoing CERCLA response action. Just a note on these sites, most of the RCRA deferrals that we have done in the past, we haven't done any in the recent years, were generally done early in the process. So either EPA had not written any records of decision for the site, or we had written a record of decision and had not yet implemented any of the activities. So I really don't anticipate seeing a lot of deletions based on RCRA deferral coming through, since I think we really cleaned up the national priorities list and got a lot of these sites off when this policy came out in the mid-90s. Next slide. All right, and as I said before, deletions are administrative, so it's all about the documentation. So what I'm going to be talking about for the documentation preparation is applicable to both deletions and partials. Next slide. So the deletion process includes, as I said before, obtaining a letter of concurrence from the state, compiling a deletion docket, preparing the notice or notices, and obtaining headquarters review and concurrence. And this is really an overview, and we'll get more into it in the next slides. Did we skip one?
No.
State concurrence, okay. So for state concurrence, if the state is not in agreement, the deletion cannot proceed. So this is not asking and then having them say no and moving forward anyways. This is a requirement. So no state concurrence, no deletion. The state should be given 30 days to comment on draft deletion notices before publication. It's recommended, and I know most regions, when I get deletions in here, most folks have already talked to their state about the possibility of deletion and or the state's probably asked for it. So it's generally not a bad idea when you're approaching your site completion milestone and working on your export and start talking to the state and making sure that they're on board for the deletion. Otherwise, you're going to be at site completion and not be able to delete until you've resolved the issues. Next, please. The deletion docket needs to be prepared to support the rulemaking in the Federal Register. It is recommended that it contains all pertinent information supporting the deletion recommendation. The deletion docket is housed in the same place as the administrative record, but it should contain all documents that are generally not in the administrative record. The administrative record supports a decision, like a record of decision, a ROD amendment, ESD. The deletion docket should reference the administrative record, but should be a standalone docket that really contains all the information to support the deletion. So we're talking about remedial action reports, RD reports, O&M reports, five-year reviews, P-Corps, F-Corps, and state concurrence letter. The deletion docket needs to be, as I said before, co-located with the administrative record in the regional office files and the local repositories, and also needs to go in the federal docket management system, which all the regions have deletion coordinators that are familiar with this process. The federal docket management system is an electronic repository that holds all supporting documentation for every rule that goes in the Federal Register. So when a Federal Register notice is published, it has a reference number that will then link to the deletion docket, so anybody who looks at the Federal Register can look at the supporting materials. This was a new change. There used to not be an electronic docket. I think the change happened in the early 2000s. So it used to just be the regional office and local repositories, but this makes it more transparent for folks looking at it electronically. Next slide, please. The mandated docket requirements from headquarters when doing concurrence is for a full deletion, at a minimum, we'd like to see the administrative record index, the state concurrence letter, and the final closeout report. Again, since deletions are generally prepared in the regions, we defer to you guys on what exactly you think is necessary to put in there. If it's a high-profile site, you may want to put some more documentation in there, the RA reports, any consent decrees, any community involvement plans that you have. If it's a site that really hasn't had much community involvement and it seems like nobody really cares about it, maybe a more streamlined deletion docket is appropriate. For a partial deletion, generally you haven't met the site completion milestone. You've only met the deletion requirements for a portion of the site, so you won't have an F-Corps. So what we're looking for at these sites is a no-action ROD or an RA report for the parcel or medias being proposed for deletion, a map clearly delineating the boundaries of the parcels. You're going to want to have some verbiage in the deletion notice that talks exactly about the parcels that you're deleting, and then, again, the state concurrence letter and the administrative record reference. Next, please. I'm going to take a break here to ask if they have any questions.
Sure. Okay, again, if you're on the phone and you'd like to ask a question, you can take yourself off of mute with the #6 command and then go ahead and ask. Those of you that are streaming the audio, of course, the question mark button is still up there to go ahead and type up your questions electronically.
This is Vincent, Region 6. Is the 30-day public comment, the 30-day state comment period, is that in the regs? I don't know offhand.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's required, the Federal Register notice requires 30-day public comment period, and you have to publish a letter or a publication in a local newspaper.
No, I'm talking about the pre-publication. It showed a 30-day comment period for the state.
Oh, for the state to review the documentation?
Yes.
Is it in the MCP? That's a good question. I can't answer that off the top of my head.
Yeah, and I don't recall.
The answer is yes, it's in the MCP.
EPA shall provide the state 30 working days for review of the deletion notice prior to its publication.
So it's 30 working days?
That's what it says. That's what the MCP says.
Oh, roughly, okay. Roughly 45 days.
I'm glad someone had the MCP. Well, if you're not doing that on your deletions, I'd suggest that you do that on your deletions.
No, it was just more about there's actually a limit on the state's review period. Beyond that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm since they have to concur, I'm assuming if they walk 45 days, you have to give it to them. But I mean, it's actually, that's a good point, because you could probably use it as a hammer to get them to maybe read it and concur on it. I know in a lot of deletions that I get on my desk, the state concurrence generally lags for months and months and months. So.
And that's usually what we see as well.
Yeah. Okay.
Any other questions or comments? Okay.
Okay. So now we're getting into the Federal Register rulemaking process. I'm going to reference for you guys to look at Exhibit 5.2 and Exhibit 5.4 in the closeout procedures guidance. I had a flowchart that sort of talks about the steps that you need from really preparing your notices to getting them published for both the two-step process and the direct rulemaking process. So I would reference those when you're going through your deletion process. I'm not going to show them on these slides because I couldn't, to be honest with you, I couldn't fit them. But they're very helpful and let you know who needs to review it, when they need to review it, what you need to prepare, and who you need to send it to. So we're briefly going to go over the two-step and direct final rulemaking process. Next, please. That's okay. Okay. As I said before, in 2008, I actually worked with OGC to get templates done for partial deletions and regular deletions for both the two-step and the final process. So really, any type of deletion you're doing, there's already a template. Since the NCP requires a lot of things like state concurrence and local newspaper publications, about half of your deletion notice generally is going to be the same for every deletion. So this really allows you to streamline your efforts and really only insert some site-specific information. The link for those is on the page on the slide here for the templates and is also can be accessed through the post-construction website that we have linked at the back. And we also have them in the additional resources. Next, please. So in a two-step rulemaking process, the NOID, or Notice of Intent to Delete, is prepared by the region. The Notice of Intent to Delete contains all the information that supports the deletion, the proposal to delete the site. So it's going to talk about the deletion process. It's also going to talk about site-specific information. All that information that you had in the F-Corps is generally going to be put into the Notice of Intent to Delete. This is a document that, once is published in the Federal Register, is commented on by the public or solicits the 30-day public comment period. Once you prepare the Notice of Intent to Delete, you're going to send it to headquarters to review, myself and your regional coordinator. We will send you comments and work through those comments, and once we believe the deletion is appropriate, you're going to obtain headquarters concurrence. Once headquarters concurrence is obtained, and I'll talk about that a little bit later, the NOID is published in the Federal Register, and concurrently, a notice is published in the newspaper letting the public know through that avenue that they have 30 days to comment on the notice that is in the register. When comments are received, the region is going to address them as appropriate, and if necessary, they're going to prepare a responsiveness summary, similar to what we do for ROD, addressing any pertinent comments. And after reviewing the comments, if the region feels that the deletion is still appropriate, they're going to prepare a second deletion notice, or a second notice, which is very short. It's about a page, which pretty much makes an effective deletion date. And the day that it is published in the Federal Register makes the deletion effective. The notice of deletion is also sent to headquarters for review. Next slide, please. Okay. So as I talked about before, the notice of intent to delete contains the EPA regional staff contacts. The templates are just going to have insert name here, type information. It talks about the deletion criteria, which we discussed earlier, as well as any concurrence requirements. And then has the site-specific information, as I said before, is pulled directly from that F-Corps that you worked so hard through with headquarters that making the deletions easy. And you're just going to really copy and paste that in there. and then send it to us for review. Next slide, please. All right, headquarters concurrence. A delegation revision signed August 1st, 2008 requires OSLR concurrence for all MTL deletions and partial deletions. It requires concurrence on the notice of intent before the RA signs. This was delegated to the OSREDI, the Superfund Office Director, who is Jim Wolfer right now. And a subsequent September 12, 2008 OSWER memo outlines the headquarters deletion review and concurrence process. In that memo, we have the procedures for going through the review process, which are sort of outlined in those flowcharts that I referenced in Exhibit 5.2 and 5.4, but also provides the memo that we send for headquarters for concurrence and a checklist that we go through whenever we do a deletion concurrence. So when we do concurrence, we're going to make sure that all other site milestones have been met. For instance, for a full deletion, the site is construction complete, it is site-wide ready for anticipated use. We review the environmental indicators to make sure that they are groundwater migration under control, human exposure under control. We're also going to look at the last five-year review, see what the protectiveness statement was and any issues and recommendations that were raised, and make sure that the deletion notice addresses any issues that were outstanding from that five-year review. We also require that the region send us the state concurrence letter, and we also go into the federal docket management system and make sure that the docket's in there. One of the things that I didn't mention before is some people are probably wondering why we concur on deletions. In 2007, there was an OIG audit on deletions, which found that for half the deletions that they reviewed, there was no deletion docket. So there was a recommendation for us to review documentation. So this was a way of us formalizing a check-the-box type event for saying that you guys have the deletion docket done without actually having to go out and look for it. And then also they found that 3 out of the 8 sites may have been deleted prematurely. Therefore, there wasn't the appropriate documentation that all the response actions were complete. So the decision here was to bring the concurrence role into headquarters to make sure that all the criteria that I outlined on that checklist have been met before the deletion is published. Next slide, please. So for headquarters concurrence, I, Kate Garufi, am the one that prepare the paperwork, so if you guys are doing any deletions, you will be dealing with me. Generally, when you prepare your deletion notice, you're going to send it to your regional coordinator and myself, and we will comment and work through the issues that we have. I will complete the concurrence checklist and send it to Jim Wolford for concurrence. Since the process has been going on for about 3 years, we don't have to brief him on every site anymore. We used to have to brief him on every site, which slowed it down a little bit. But once I'm okay with it and I prepare the paperwork, it generally takes about a week for it to get out to the region. So it's a relatively painless process if you really take the time when you're preparing your final closeout report to work with us in headquarters to make sure that you've got all the information, just to make it relatively painless on the back end. Next slide, please. So the regional administrator actually signs the notice of intent to delete. This is not a delegated responsibility, so the RA must sign the notice of intent. And again, if you guys in the regions are preparing the package, you're going to want to make sure that the headquarters concurrence memo is on the RA's desk before the notice of intent to delete is signed. We've had 2 instances where that did not happen, and we required the regions to withdraw the notices, get headquarters concurrence, and republish since it did not follow the delegation protocols. So I would recommend that you get your headquarters concurrence before the RA signs it, or it will be a lot of administrative pain for you and your folks in the region. The deletion package is prepared in the region for Federal Register publication. It includes a signed notice, 4 single-sided hard copies, the typesetting request, and a CD containing the notice. It's sent to the Federal Register Publication Office in headquarters, and it typically takes 4 business days to publish it. Once the Federal Register Office receives the package, they'll let you know what day they're going to publish it, which will help you know what day to publish your local notice in the newspaper so you can coordinate the two activities. All right, next slide. And for the local notice, the community involvement coordinator generally prepares and distributes the notice. It's published in the same day, and the RPM, or community involvement coordinator, should let the trustees know that this is happening. Next slide. I've already sort of talked about this. If you guys receive, again, if you receive comments, it's really at the region's discretion on how you want to address them. Sometimes we get comments on deletions that have nothing to do with the deletion. It might just be an angry rant about Superfund or something completely unrelated to the site. It depends really on you guys on how you want to address them, but we would recommend any comments that are relevant to the action be addressed in the responsiveness summary sent to headquarters for review, and the copy of the responsiveness summary needs to be put in the docket. Next slide, please. And once all that is done, if the deletion is still appropriate, the notice of deletion is prepared. It is sent to headquarters for review. It's about a page, so it'll take someone at headquarters 5 seconds to read it, so that's not a pain. And then it is, a package is prepared similar to the package for the notice of intent to delete, sent to the Federal Register Office and published. All right, so that's the traditional two-step process. The direct deletion process is intended to be a more streamlined process. If you receive adverse comments, it ends up being a pain in the butt, but if you don't, it actually ends up being a nice process to follow. What happens here is the RPM prepares the notice of intent to delete and directs notice of deletion. These templates are a little bit different than the traditional process based on how they're published in the Federal Register. Again, those templates are available online. They're sent to headquarters for review and concurrence. They are both published at the same time in the newspaper, or excuse me, in the Federal Register, and a notice is published in the newspaper. If adverse comments are received during the 30-day public comment period, and by adverse, again, that's at the discretion of the region is then required to withdraw the direct deletion notice, which has an effective deletion date, prepare a responsiveness summary, and then republish a new notice of deletion only if the deletion is found to be appropriate after responding to the comment. So we're going to go into this in a little bit more detail in the next couple of slides. All right, so here's sort of a little visual, a visual representation of the direct deletion timeline. On the top, you have the process. If it goes wonderfully and you get no comments, you publish both the notice of intent to delete and the notice of deletion. The notice of deletion has an effective deletion date 60 days after the publication date. So you're going to publish both of them. You're going to wait the 30 days. If you don't have any comments in the 30 days, then you just wait another 30 days and it becomes effective without any more administrative requirements by the region. If you get adverse comments, as you see from the bottom, there's a lot more that needs to be done. If an adverse comment is received during the 30-day comment period, the region has to publish a withdrawal notice in the Federal Register before the effective deletion date. So if you get an adverse comment on the 30th date, you have 30 days to prepare a withdrawal notice and get it in the Federal Register to pull out that effective date before it goes final. Again, once you get an adverse comment, you're going to address the comment in a responsiveness summary, and only if it's appropriate, you would prepare a new notice of deletion. You don't need a new comment period, but you would prepare a new notice of deletion, including the responsiveness summary, publish it, and that would be the effective deletion date. Next, please. So the difference between the templates for the direct deletion process versus the traditional one is the notice of intent to delete is much shorter. It's about a page and a half, and all it really does is describe the circle authority and solicit public comment on the intent to delete or partially delete the site. The notice of intent to delete, as I said before, has an effective deletion date 60 days after the publication date and really contains the meat of the deletion, the rationale for the deletion. It contains all the site-specific information as well as the deletion criteria from the NCP. Next, please. As I said before, the headquarters concurrence is the same. You're just going to send both notices to us. The RA signs both notices once headquarters concurrence has been received. The two packages must be prepared, one for each notice, and the notices are published on the same day in the Federal Register. One's published in the direct rule section. The other one's published in the proposed rule section. If no adverse comments are received, the deletion is effective on the date the direct noise specifies. All right. So if you do a direct deletion and a disgruntled person sends you an adverse comment, you have to do a withdrawal. The template is available on the website where the other templates are. It's a pretty short document that really is just pulling the effective date from the direct notice of deletion. It's signed by the RA, and the same publication requirements for publishing it in the Federal Register are followed for all the other deletion notices. Next, I covered everything else here. Let's see. As I said before, if the deletion is still appropriate, you prepare a notice of deletion, which is the same as the two-step rulemaking. The second comment period is not necessary, and the publication is consistent with the deletion notice in the two-step process. Next. So the take-home message there is, if you think you're going to have anyone comment on your deletion, do not do the direct deletion process. It becomes an administrative nightmare. But if you think no one will comment, it is a lovely way to go. So I know that was very administrative and probably sort of boring for you folks. It's a lot of information, and it really is sort of hard to comprehend until you have to go through the process. Does anyone have any questions?
Remember, it's #6 to unmute if you're on the phone, or you can use the question mark button to type up your questions electronically.
Probably sleeping.
We're awake. You were just crystal clear.
I know. It's so boring.
No, we're hanging on because we were promised a big cash bonus if we stuck to the end.
Hey.
Yes.
If you get any comment, is that considered adverse?
You know, I generally defer to your counsel, but I know that some regions will take the position that any comment is an adverse comment. I know other folks have only taken adverse to mean something that really questions the validity of the deletion.
I mean, yeah, somebody could comment they support it. It's a good idea. That's not adverse. I mean, you know.
No, I agree, but I mean, I don't know what region it was, but pulled a deletion back for somebody saying that, you know, wrote a comment saying Superfund is the devil or something like that. So, I mean, it all depends on how conservative your counsel is. I don't know. I mean, but again, you know, if you get comments that support the deletion, I wouldn't pull it back. But if you get some nasty comment from someone that's disgruntled, I defer to you guys. Because I can't get anyone to tell me what it means here, so I defer to the regional counsel.
All right, thanks.
Any other questions or comments on the phone? We do have a question that came in online. This is also coming from Chicago. And they mentioned, or it's more of a comment, I guess, the guidance addresses record deferral but not state enforcement deferral. And they want to know if this is a challenge that's particular to their region or if others are experiencing that problem.
Well, Tom, I know that it's generally your region has a lot more sites in that boat than other regions. Do other regions have sites that are deferred to, that are on the MPL that are deferred to state enforcement entities that they're having issues with in?
We've got a couple, but we're not having these issues. We're having other issues with them. We can't get anything done.
We don't have any in Region 1 anymore. We took them back.
We have a bunch of other state lead sites that under this current interpretation of the guidance, we're going to have to write NFA rods on someday.
Are those the Washington Ecology landfills?
Yeah, those and other similar and Happily, I'll be retired by the time they're ready to go.
Okay, any other questions or comments? Again, this is your chance.
Yeah, does anyone have any questions on anything from RA completion to deletion? Any thoughts?
Hello, this is Camille again from Region 6. I have a question about some of the significant changes in this guidance, particularly the definition of interim RA going away, final RA being replaced by the F-Corps. Have those translated yet to surplus? And the reason I'm asking is because those are trackable accomplishments for the program.
Basically, good question. Thank you. How it used to work in CERCLIS was that there was a qualifier on the remedial action completion action that when you entered an actual completion date, there was a qualifier where you entered either IR or FR for whether it was an interim report or final report, and that was the only way to get the beam for RA completion. That went away a couple of months ago so that reporting in order to count the accomplishments for the RA completion measure no longer requires that qualifier is selected.
Okay, right.
So it doesn't change anything else about, you know, when you enter that completion date or anything, but you no longer see that box to pick the qualifier.
I think there's a couple more slides.
Okay, if there are any other questions or comments, we'll go right ahead, and I think we're resuming on slide number 102.
All right, so just to wrap up, we wanted to include some helpful websites for everyone. There's the Closeout Procedures Guidance website, and then the Post-Construction Completion website, which not only has CC and deletion information, but, you know, you can also get to O&M and LTRA policies and O&F policies and five-year review stuff through there. So it's a good website to put on the in the save category. And then also the Remedial Design Remedial Action website. Although we've been talking about closeout procedures, the RA report sort of, you know, dabbles a little bit into the RDRA arena. So there's a lot of information and guidance in there as well, including the RDRA handbook, which I think sort of plays into the RA report a little bit. And then the next slide. These are our contact information. We're more than happy to field any questions you have. We love the good ones. We love debating them for a good half hour or so. You know, if we can't answer your question, I'm sure we can find someone that can. Don't hesitate to email us or call us or whatever you need to do. I guess the next one is are you going to do the survey or?
Yes.
Okay. We encourage you guys to fill out the survey. This is the first delivery of the training for the new guidance. We only open this to EPA employees, so we're probably, if you guys think it's appropriate for us to open this to the general state, federal agency, other stakeholder group, you know, we can be persuaded. So if you want to let us know through the feedback form, that would be cool.
I think Tom thinks it's
good. Yeah, Tom thinks it's a good idea.
So with that, I'm going to have everybody move on to slide number 104, which is the final slide in the packet. And there you're going to see two links. The first one is a link to the additional resources page. That very same link is available on the seminar homepage. On the left side, there's a button that says links, and it will bring you to a collection of resources, some of the websites that were mentioned in today's presentation, a copy of the slides to actually download, as well as a copy of the guidance document that they were discussing throughout today's presentation. The other very important link is the feedback form link. That is also available on the seminar homepage. There should be a button on the left side that says feedback. And on that feedback form, you'll have the opportunity to let us know what you thought of today's presentation. And as they were mentioning, it's incredibly important if you'd like to see this delivered again, you'd like to see this training offered to states or other stakeholders, please be sure to include your comments in there. Also, let me know what you thought of this session. I do read each and every one of the comments that go in there, so if there were any difficulties, if you want to see the training delivered in a different way, please know your comments and feedback will be received and read with an actual person. So one thing to note, though, if you share the line with multiple individuals, when you fill out the feedback form, you'll have the option to actually check a box and have a confirmation email sent to you for your own records. So if there were several people who registered and participate under one spot or one person's entry, when you fill out the feedback form, there's an option to click and have a confirmation message sent to one person, and then there will be a link that will appear once you submit feedback to let the next person hop on and fill out their own form, and they can have their own confirmation sent to them for their own records. So if you keep track of training that you participate in, you can at least get a record that way. There will be an automated email that will go out. So for those of you who shared the line but registered on your own, don't be alarmed if you see an email asking why you weren't there. Just reply and let me know you shared the line with somebody else so I can keep track of the headcount for today. And again, depending on the review of the archive, if the instructor is deemed that it's worthy, we'll make it available and you'll get an automatic email to let you know if and when that's available. So those are the ends of the reminders that I have. Any closing comments from John or Kate?
No, just we really would appreciate feedback since this was the first time for the new guidance. So really any thoughts would be much appreciated before we take it broader. So.
And one quick thing, Tim in Region 10, are there really 250 people in the room with you, or was that a typo when you entered that number in?
I was being optimistic about the number that were going to show up. We didn't get quite that many.
Okay, all right. Thanks, sir. I appreciate it. All right, well then, with that, I want to extend my thanks to all of you across the EPA in the various regions who were able to take time and participate, who actively engaged our presenters with questions. And in advance, for those of you filling out that feedback form, please, please, please fill out that form if you can. If you can't do it right now, that link will remain active, so you can go back to it at any time to fill it out. And I also thank our organizers here in Australia who put together the training. We appreciated working with you today. And that will be the formal conclusion for today's presentation. I'll be terminating the phone call, closing out the online broadcast, and I hope all you guys have the rest of your day is a pleasant one. Thank you all very much.